Enter. If you dare.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, man?
It is going well.
Excellent. And also joining us in the state of New York.
This is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I've been better. How are you?
Hanging in there. And in the state of Massachusetts.
Hey, everyone, this is Abe.
Abe, how are you?
Hanging in there.
Very good. And we have someone that's a Connecticut American. Who is it?
That would be me, Christy Peterson Schoonover.
Christy, how's it going?
Great. Excellent. I'm really happy to be here.
Yes, very good. And we're glad to have you. Today is October 1st, 2015 for the recording. So the first day of Halloween month. Before we begin, let's go around. And Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find it on Stitcher or in the iTunes store.
Very good. And Mike, in there in New York, you do something?
I do a lot of things in New York, some of which I can't mention. But yeah, I have a blog I occasionally update, which is unnaturalselections.com.
Excellent. And Abe, you do a blog too?
Yep, it's called A Realer Movie Reviewer. It's a multi-genre blog, which you can find by going to your basic search engine. Realer spelled R-E-E-L-E-R Movie Reviewer. Or, to make it easier, you can go down to Dr. Gustin's main page and look on the right-hand side. You'll also find links to all the other sites mentioned by Eric and Mike, along with other goodies.
That's right, and Abe is referring to www.darkdiscussions.com, and on the right of the front page are links to Eric's other podcasts, as well as the blogs that Abe and Mike do, and links to our sister podcast, You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast, as well as, of course, all the episodes of the podcast that you can also find on Stitcher and iTunes. And at the bottom of every page of www.darkdiscussions.com are links to all these things, including the Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast, darkdiscussions@aol.com, Twitter, darkdiscussion1, and the RSS feed. And also, as Abe said about the other goodies on the side of the front page on the right, there's links to Christy Peterson Schoonover's website. And Christy, what would you like to mention that you do and so forth?
Well, I'm a short story writer. I mostly do dark fiction, short stories. I have one novel available called Bad Apple. I have a novella out called This Poison Ground, and I have a collection of short stories set in Disney parks called Skeletons in the Swimming Hole, Tales from Haunted Disney World. And you can either go to the link on Dark Discussions to find out more about me, or just Google Christy Peterson Schoonover, and no matter how you butcher it, you'll find me, because there's only one of me so far, as far as I know. Thank God.
Well, and recently, yeah.
It's an emerging market.
You posted something on Facebook recently because you were actually on vacation in Disney World, and I think I commented that I feel sorry for any tour group that gets you in it.
You did, and I loved that comment. It was so I was so proud of it. I showed my friends. I was like, look, I could be a tour guide.
The poor tour guide's going to be like, well, yeah, here we have.
Do you correct the tour guide?
Be like, well, actually, you know, the first time that was built was in 1943, but it burnt to the ground under unusual circumstances, and then.
Actually, I have done the Keys to the Kingdom tour, and it was a 6-hour tour with lunch. And to answer Mike's question, no, I did not correct the tour guide, because you're with a group of 25 other guests, and you figure those guests, they maybe are not as geeky as me, and it's really not my job. Like,
but,
you know,
but don't,
it's not
if they're
my
not,
job.
If they're not as geeky as you, don't they deserve to be punished for that?
But Christy, of course, you don't want to be. No one wants to be that annoying tourist. That
exactly, I don't want to be the asshole. You know,
I totally want to be that annoying tourist.
Although I will say that me and the two people I was with, this was years ago, this was in 08, the tour guide, when we had lunch, the tour guide sat with me and my two friends. And that was really cool. Cause then I got to talk to him one-on-one about some things, and that was really cool. And then I was able to point out some things and say, yeah, and this, you said this, but it's really this. And he's like, yeah, well, they kind of give us a script and they won't let us say certain things. But he was really nice. So that was cool. So, and I have my official Keys to the Kingdom tour key pin, which you can only get if you take the tour. So
yeah, there
I'm
you
very
go.
Proud that I own it. But yeah.
Nice. So excellent.
Someday that's going to be my job when I move there, I hope.
There you go. So let's see. Let's discuss some of the things in genre news or things we've watched or read that are related to genre and speculative fiction. And I guess I'll start. I saw the latest Strain, and it is going well. The season finale is this weekend. Looking forward to that. I watched a few minutes of episode, I think five or four of, actually four of, Fear the Walking Dead, and I think I may be giving up on that show as well.
Lasted one episode longer than I did.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. But Phil was singing its praises.
Yeah,
the first two episodes.
Yeah.
Well, the first two episodes, and then yeah.
The third one was where I lost interest.
Yeah, that's where they took the third one. I think is where they took the 4 to 6 weeks in advance, isn't it?
But it only advanced a couple of days.
Wait, when the government took over?
Yeah, that was only about a week.
Oh well, that was unfortunate, and that's when it's just kind of not too good. I was disappointed how they advanced it so quickly. I liked the apocalypse slowly happening, you know, like they're doing in The Strain, I guess. Also, I watched episodes 9 and 10 of season 5 of The Walking Dead. I bought the Blu-ray set of that, and was episodes 9 and 10, yeah. And I was very disappointed with both of those episodes. I thought they sucked. So I don't know when I'm going to revisit the last 6 episodes of season 5. I was hoping to watch them all before season 6 started this weekend, or 2 weekends from now, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to because of my disappointment. I, however, did decide to watch some Grindhouse films, both modern and in the past, because of how Eli Roth's Green Inferno has come to the theaters, as well as Rodney Terrell, one of our contributors on the Facebook group, is doing a list of 40 films to Halloween or 50 films to Halloween. Yeah, so I decided to watch Planet Terror and Hobo with a Shotgun, and I'm glad I revisited both of those films. Those films are really great films, fantastic stuff, no doubt about it. I then rewatched Cheap Thrills, and again, that holds up. And then Zombievers.
Zombievers.
You can get the Blu-ray of Zombievers only at Best Buy, I guess. And I picked it up there, and so I watched that, and that was pretty damn good. So that's pretty much my stuff. What about you, Eric?
Well, I watched the movie we were originally going to record about tonight, but I guess we'll have to save that for another time. And other than that, I've been pretty busy, I guess. The only thing I've really watched is I've been in season 10 of Supernatural. So that is, I mean, it's mediocre Supernatural. It reached its low point in season 7 and bounced back in season 8, but it's been pretty steady since then. It hasn't really gotten really great again, and it's not as bad, so it's just been kind of steady mediocre since season 8. I did finish reading the book, The Martian, which is opening as a movie in theaters tomorrow. So, I enjoyed that book, a great deal. And, I've read this comparison on the internet and found it to be true from reading the book, which is that if you watched Apollo 13 and liked the sequences where they were trying to repurpose equipment for different things, then you will probably like The Martian.
Yay!
Because that's what it's all about.
About me.
He's on a planet with a bunch of stuff that he's got to use to survive. That's all he's got.
Thank God the aliens left all that technology behind.
So I enjoyed The Martian. I can recommend that. But that's really all I've been up to for the past week.
All right, very good. And the reviews for The Martian are absolutely fantastic. Over 150 reviews, and all of them are good except for 12, I think. And it appears that this is a rebound for Ridley Scott after a couple of what some people would say misfires, even though they do have their fans, such as Kingdom of Heaven and Prometheus and various
Prometheus
other films.
Was a masterpiece.
Well, Martian's supposed to be. Oh, so maybe. Oop. Yeah, well. So, yeah,
but notice this is the first one that I can think of in a while that he's done that it basically was completely taking somebody else's material.
Right.
Yes, that's a good point. Excellent point, Mike.
And that's because not every good director is necessarily a good writer.
And vice versa.
Well, and this is, and it's not original material.
Exhibit A, Stephen King.
It's based off of a book. So you're right. That probably helps a lot because like Prometheus was made up by a couple of screenwriters and so on and so forth. And this one here is based off of best-selling novel. So good point, Mike. Excellent point. All right. So what about you, Mike?
I've had a head cold for the last few days. We had a fall foliage festival where I took one for the school in fundraising and had some pies thrown in my face. And for some reason, and I learned one thing, which is that the people of my hometown, suck at throwing pies. 'Cause they couldn't hit the broadside of a barn.
Okay.
But two assholes paid extra money to make sure they could walk right up and shove it up my face.
That happened.
I was like, yeah, it was my mom and dad. But anyway, so I've really been zonked out, and that's going to affect my discussion of tonight's entry. And the movie we were supposed to review tonight that Eric was alluding to, I'm the reason we're not reviewing the movie we're supposed to review tonight because it's playing nowhere near me.
I don't think it's going to be either.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm hoping it's still playing someplace tomorrow. It's just that it's every place was over an hour away. And, I'm hoping it's somewhere within an hour or an hour to 90 minutes away so I can catch it this weekend. Or I don't know what I'm going to do. But I did watch, before I got sick, I watched Cooties, which I enjoyed.
Dan's wife is actually a teacher. And often she will grade homework over at my place while we do the Scansity podcast. And then afterwards we'll watch a movie while she continues to grade her homework. So I'm saving that for when Susie's over grading homework.
Okay. It was fine. It's not brilliant. And I wouldn't put it up as high as What We Do in the Shadows or Zombievers necessarily. But it was certainly enjoyable. Not nearly enough child abuse to really thrill me.
That's not something you hear very often.
Well, I mean, like, for me, like, I love, come out and play was saved at the end when he's beating the crap out of the kids with the oar. I was like, yes, I could just keep that on replay over and over and over again. But it was fun. It was fun enough. And the characters were likable and it was well written. So I enjoyed that. I'm still going through Fear of the Walking Dead, and it's, there. I'm with Phil in that I would prefer to have seen a little bit of the stuff that they fast-forwarded through, but they fast-forwarded through very little, and I'm pretty sure that I'm the odd person out in terms of municipal management in the zombie apocalypse, probably being an interesting topic. But it is in a place now where it's not doing stuff you could have done in the regular Walking Dead. But what I find interesting, I've found out about this, is that the series originally started because Kirkman and the other showrunner basically pitched an idea for an apocalypse story in which they discover a meteor is heading to strike the Earth. And basically they've got like 5 years before it hits, and it would be how does society respond and react to that? And the network said, but there's no zombies in it, and they didn't want to do the show. And so they sort of repurposed the script and redid it.
Sounds
so
something it may, like about tonight's movie.
Sounds like something that might be relevant for tonight's episode, yeah. I think it was the other showrunner who had the topic and brought it to the pitch and brought it to Kirkman, and then they brought it there. Anyway, I think actually I would have been more interested in seeing and would have had more possibilities. But I realized a while ago that with The Walking Dead, what I really wanted to see was have them look at different levels of society. I would love to see like what was going on in the presidency in the White House and what's happening in different countries. And then I realized, oh, wait a minute, that was World War Z.
Right.
You know, so really I wanted World War Z, the movie, the TV series, which they're not making and they're never going to. I was trying to think. Oh, I got my I mentioned a few months ago I've been subscribing to Horror Block. I just got my new Horror Block subscription package in the mail. I had some neat stuff. I had a Silence of the Lambs t-shirt with the Death's Head butterfly on it, or moth, rather. It had some vinyl figures of Yaphet Kotto and the alien from Alien. And for some reason, I guess they imagine that horror fans don't already own a DVD copy of Night of the Living Dead, because I got one of those. So, which I thought was funny. But, you know, it is something if you're interested in little, and it also comes with subscription to, with Rumor Magazine. So the latest issue is packaged in every box. So it's something that if you're a horror fan, I would suggest looking into. It's not bad. It's like $20 a month, and then whatever shipping and handling is. And for that, you get the magazine, which is usually like $8 on its own, the t-shirts, which are often $15 to $20 on their own, and then whatever promotional materials they get to toss in there. So I like this month's box. Thanks for the last couple of months have been pretty good. And with Halloween coming up, I'm sure there'll be an even better one. But anyway, Mike. Oh, and Scream Queens. I know, Phil, you've been talking about Scream Queens. Did you do that last week?
I forget if I did mention it, but yeah, I watched it too. Go on, Mike.
Yeah, I liked it. It's very stylized, and that might not work for people, right? It's not naturalistic in any way.
Right.
You know, it's very snappy patter and snappy dialogue, but it's filled with a bunch of unlikable bitches that we can all enjoy watching get whacked over the next few months.
It's like Heathers almost. Super real. Type of thing.
And there's you know, just the caricatures that they have of the sorority girls, you know, like you, who is it? Deaf Taylor Swift and Predatory Les and, you know, it was fun. You know, that all the sorority girls at the start have, you know, basically are, who is it? What's the name? Chanel is the lead.
That's right.
And she can't be bothered memorizing the names of her underlings. So it's just Chanel number one, Chanel number two, all the way up to naturally Chanel number five.
Actually, I don't think there is a Chanel number one because that one disappeared.
Oh, right, she would be number one, so it's number two, three, four.
Yeah, something like that. And then it's like
five,
and they skip one because one quit the sorority and just disappeared or something.
She disappeared. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, it seems like it's fun. It's not going to take itself too seriously. Jamie Lee Curtis is in it, and she's enjoyable, but she
plays the dean of the college.
Right, but she almost feels like she walked in appropriately enough. She feels like she's in a completely different thing because she doesn't have the same snappy patter. She almost feels like a different character in a different film that's sort of being forced to be in this.
Well, actually, she almost, what it is she's, I think she was told to play it straight, unlike other people. Yeah, which is kind of interesting how they do that.
Right, and I think it works because she is antagonistic to these sorority girls. But, it's a lot of fun, and I would recommend checking it out if anyone has any reservations. Oh, and I mentioned also a couple of months ago the CBS series Zoo.
Yes.
Which was the animals, which I only saw the first episode, but it's on Netflix now, so you can watch the whole thing, which is awful, on Netflix for free after you paid for Netflix. If you're into cheesy animal attack stuff, you might enjoy it as much as I'm ashamed to admit I'm enjoying it.
Very good. Anything else, Mike?
Under the Dome is over, so we can thank God for that.
Never watched it, so never affected my life. Anything else, Mike?
No, that's it.
All right, very well. And what about you, Abe?
I've been really busy this week, so I only had enough time to fit in our topic for tonight.
All right, very good. And what about you, Chrissy?
I watched the found footage film, The Devil's Due.
Oh, yeah. Sorry that on Facebook.
Yeah, I can't say it was as god-awful as everybody said it was. I don't get all the hate. Is it great? No. Can I recommend it? Not really. no, I can't, but it was fun. I enjoyed it. If you like found footage like I do and you're a found footage freak, then you should just see it anyway. But it's not even really found footage. They kind of do some weird shifts in perspective there that kind of make it more of a mashup. I then watched a movie called Thaw, which stars Val Kilmer.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. It was about a researcher researching global warming and his mammoth, this mammoth thaws, and it has this parasite. Yeah, it was kind of like The Thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a ripoff of The Thing, yeah.
Yeah, but I enjoyed it. The one that surprised me that I thought was totally going to suck, and I got a total surprise, was Don't Blink. It's a plot-driven mystery. The kid who plays Scott Farkas from A Christmas Story is in it as a grown-up. There's not a lot of character development. You don't really get to know the characters, but honestly, you don't care. The beauty of this movie is that you're on the edge of your seat the whole time trying to figure out what's going on, and they never tell you. They don't tell you. They don't solve the mystery. So it is one heck of a ride, and I have to give it a high recommend just because it's really fun. I also went and saw Everest in IMAX 3D. The only reason I'm mentioning this, Phil, is I have a correction to make. On the Stakeland episode, I noted that the film is not based on Krakauer's book Into Thin Air. That's true. At the end of the film, they rolled credits and they listed a couple of books they had used to base the film on, but it went by so fast I couldn't read them. But what I said is that the book Into Thin Air was about a different expedition, and it's not. It is about the 1996 expedition. I read that book when it first came out, and the reality is I've read so many Everest books, I got confused about which books were which. Like, I have a tub of Everest books in the basement. So I just want to apologize to the listeners and correct that error, because it is based on the 1996 expedition. On the small screen, I watched the opening of season 2 of the comedy The Last Man on Earth. Have you guys seen that?
Yes.
I'm really getting a kick out of that series. I just think it's so much fun. It's intelligent. It's really funny. I love when they soak in kiddie swimming pools full of tequila. It's just really great. And
it's also for a comedy. It's got a gut punch of an ending, I thought.
It's really a lot of fun. I've been looking forward to season 2. I rewatched season 1 before the season 2 opener. And I went to some live theater this week. Rosebud, The Lives of Orson Welles, which is a one-man play. Nice. And it was acted by one of my friends, Kevin Sausby, who's a very talented local actor. I do a lot of community theater work backstage, and I used to act. So, I have a lot of friends in that community around here. But genre fans might be interested, because my favorite Orson Welles piece is a little black and white short film he did called Ghost Story. It's sometimes referred to as Return to Glenniscall. And you can find it on YouTube for anyone who's interested. It's very Twilight Zone-y. He made it when he was in the process of trying to finish Othello, and there was a breakdown in the filming. He had to wait a few weeks or something. So he kind of filmed this little ghost story. So if anybody out there is interested, it's really fun. It's called Return to Glenniscall. If you Google that, you can find it on YouTube for free. It's about 22 minutes long. The only copy that's available to buy is on videotape. Which, yes, I actually own. But for anybody out there that doesn't want to deal with videotape, you can find it on YouTube.
All right.
That's
very
it.
Good.
I had a busy week.
Very good. Very good. Also, if people want to go to the Facebook group, I put up a question and pinned it. And the only activity so far is Chrissy actually liked the question. But the question is, should Dark Discussions do an episode on the brand new Danish horror film When Animals Dream? And you can
and this
vote.
Is
That's
Phil's way of trying to push through an episode on the movie since he couldn't get us to agree to it.
Is this the one that somebody didn't finish watching because...
Yes, Mike, yes.
Okay.
Because you fell asleep or whatever. Not because of the film, but because that day...
No, I just got interrupted and never was able to get back to it. I did forget, because, you know, my head's there, we caught The Visit last night.
Oh, okay.
I still want to see that.
I would definitely recommend it. It's good. It's quiet. There's not a lot of real scares in it, but it's entertaining. And I don't want to say there's a twist in it, because it's to say there's a twist, it implies it's some sort of sixth sense sort of thing. It's like, well, if you watch the clues, you can figure. It's not.
I would say it's a twist, but it's not a surprise.
There's a dramatic turn in the story. You're right. And I'm watching it, trying to figure out, you know, exactly, like, waiting, like, I'm thinking, is it going to turn out to be that the mom's the actual evil one, or instead of grandma or grandpa, who are just senile, what's, you know, I did not see coming what would end up coming.
Although,
it was good.
Looking back on it, they do drop a few hints.
Well, they drop things that make sense in hindsight.
Exactly. Yep.
Right. So I would recommend it, and it does have one of the wince-inducing scenes. Like I mentioned the pie in the face earlier. So yeah, so Eric knows what Eric, I'm not going to say what it is, but Eric knows what I'm talking about.
And there are actually a couple of pretty powerful moments in the movie as well. There's a couple of child actors in there, and there's a couple of specific moments in the movies where they really just turn it on, because the movie's mostly found footage, because the girl in the movie wants to be a filmmaker, and she's making a documentary, so that's their mechanism for having it be found footage. But there are a couple of moments in there where the kids really turn on the acting skill, and it's pretty impressive.
Right, and the 12-year-old or 13-year-old brother wants to be a rapper, which is a running joke throughout the movie.
It's pretty thoroughly amusing because he's...
Yeah, and the kids are actually entertaining more than annoying.
Mm-hmm.
But credibly so.
Yeah, we were going to go see that, but we own every other M. Night movie. So we have so
Hold
many
on.
Other.
Hold on, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Is this?
Wait.
Is
did
this
you
a confession?
Buy the happening?
Is this a confession?
Yeah.
Are you admitting?
It is.
You
I'm admitting.
Money to yes. own a copy of The Happening.
I do. I own them all.
All right.
I own everything.
You
put
in a, oh, all right. Get her off. Get her out of here. You could have said it was a gift.
Nope. I actually own every single one. So I said to Nathan, in light of all the other movies I want to see that aren't just genre coming out, now that my husband no longer works at the movie theater, nothing is free. And I was like, you know what? I really want to see The Visit, but there's all these other things I want to see, like The Martian. I want to see Steve Jobs. I want to see all these other things. I'm like, something's got to be cut. And the reality is we're going to end up buying The Visit anyway, so we have the whole set. So I'll just wait.
Right, and with the stuff that's out there now, I mean, again, I always advocate seeing stuff in movies, theaters as much as possible. But you compare that to The Martian or Everest or
exactly, yep,
or The Walk, and those are films that like they're like screaming to see on a big screen.
Yeah, like
I don't
the
know.
The Walk,
that,
I can't wait to see on IMAX 3D. That's going to be amazing. Like, I'd rather spend the $20 a ticket, because that's what it costs here to go to IMAX 3D to see that, than to go see The Visit, which I know I'm going to buy anyway. So,
and I don't think you lose a lot. Although, I got to tell you, I would love the woman sitting in the aisle across from us. I want her at every single one of my horror movies.
Why? Is she fun? Was she fun?
Oh, well, she was like, ah! You know, she just had like the jump and the laugh at yourself. And
oh, great.
You know, there's, so cool. It was like, we were like the only... Me, Pam, and like this group of three people, and that was it. But there was like they were enough to give the audience response that the film needed.
Now, Mike, is this worthy of an episode of Dark Discussion since it's a brand new horror film?
I think it could be. I don't know if Eric thinks it would be.
I agree.
Well, right. if you guys want to do an episode and want to have me on, then I'll go to the theater and see it. So,
if it's still playing after now, because it's been out for almost a month now, right?
two or 3 weeks.
Yeah, I actually think it's more likely for that to keep playing than the other movie we're going to get to.
I checked; it is playing tomorrow, so we'll be able to catch it. I don't know yet. 2 weeks from now, it might be completely out.
No, we'll see.
But it's funny; like I haven't. There's been nothing in theaters I wanted to see for the last 2 months, and now it's...
Oh, it's ridiculous. I went with Nathan and Charles before Everest, and I literally saw, like, five trailers, and all three of us were like, oh, my God, we have to see that. Oh, my God, we have to see that. Oh, my God, we have to see that. And I'm sitting here adding up the ticket prices in my head going, oh, my God, it's going to be a $400 month at the movies, like, which is cool. I love going to the movies, but it's pricey, you know? So.
Yep. Yep. Well, that's what happens when you were spoiled to get free films for so long.
That's why God invented matinees.
Yep, yeah, that's why I'm going at 10 o'clock on Saturday to see the other film we were going to do tonight.
Hell yeah.
Because it'll only be like $5 to go. And I'm like, well, I guess I can get up at 5 at 10 o'clock on a Saturday and go see it.
And FYI, that other movie that we haven't named, when I went to see it, there were me and I think three other people in the theater, and one of them got up and walked out.
But you know what? Some people will walk out because of the topic rather than if it was a good or bad film.
Yes.
Yes. So just a.
Well, it's actually one that even though I wanted to see it, once I found out what it was about, I was not thrilled with the idea that I had committed. But that's why this podcast has been really good for me, because it's making me go see things that I wouldn't normally see. And I'm always pleasantly surprised. I always learn things, so it's good.
Not always pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on.
There is the gallows.
All right. So that's pretty much it. I think, like we said, there's the Martians coming out. The Martian. Abe and me will be at a book fair Saturday, October 3rd. With Stephen King's son, Joe Hill, best-selling authors, Brian Keene, Christopher Golden, among many others, in Andover, I think it is. Is it Andover, Abe?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going.
I think so.
I'm going as a New England Horror Writers Association member and going to be at their table. Abe's going with his mother, actually, who's also a writer, as fans of various authors there.
Oh, and speaking of Brian Keene, I highly recommend anyone listening go online and look up Mike Lombardo's short film, Fast Zombies Suck, based on a Brian Keene short story. I cannot speak correctly tonight to save my life. And it's only about 10 minutes. It's starting to win some prizes. They debuted at Scares the Care back in July.
Yep.
And it goes from being... laughing, for me, if you're a zombie fan, from starting out sort of laughing at yourself and nodding to laughing at what's happening on screen and to sort of a gut punch at the end. And I really, it's not very long. Like I said, it's less than 10 minutes, I think. And it's free to stream online. Just go look for Fast Zombies Suck.
Right.
Brian Keene short story directed by Mike Lombardo, who is, I think, a talented young director. And I'm hoping he gets some fire somewhere.
Very good. And one last thing before we begin our topic. Chrissy, explain, tell us how the Whittier event went and what the Whittier event was.
Oh, all right, I'm going to do it really fast. There was an anthology that was released with a number of short stories that were commissioned by horror writers, and the collection is called Snowbound with Zombies, and they are stories, horror stories or supernatural stories based on the work of John Greenleaf Whittier. All the sales go, every dime goes to the actual museum. You can find it on Amazon. My short story, Shreds of Black, is in there. This past weekend, we had a wonderful opening. The opening went very well. People came from as far as Maine, to come and hear our readings and get a free tour of the museum and make donations to the museum. It was in Haverhill, Massachusetts. We all had a great time. Writers Scott and Dave Godsward, we all went out to dinner at this awesome Chinese restaurant after this Asian place called Wang's Table. The food was amazing. So are the Mai Tais, by the way. But it was really well attended, and everybody was very happy. And there were lots of cows, which made my husband happy because he was able to pet the cows because he's a farmer and he was into that. And anyway, their beehives are doing extraordinarily well, which is good news because they're trying to reinvigorate the orchard. So they had purchased bees to try to repollinate the orchard, and the hive is doing very well. James Moore, who, Phil, I believe you're going to – well, you won't see him in Andover this weekend because he's actually down in Georgia at Monsterama. But James Moore came by and supported us, and John McElveen was there, and Faye Ringel was there. And it was just – it was the Dent sisters were there, Gregory Norris. It was a really good time. We had a really good crowd. We sold a lot of books, which surprised us, and it was a great time. So there you go. Nice.
Now, I guess with that stated, Eric, why don't you tell everybody what we're going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we are going to be discussing a movie, an Australian movie, called These Final Hours.
Is there anybody out there? It happened. Approximate location of impact, the North Atlantic. As I speak to you right now, it's making its way towards our fair nation. We have 12 hours, people.
We're already dead. It's gonna hurt. And I don't want to feel it. I don't want to feel a thing.
I hope you're looking after yourselves out there and each other. These are things we gotta hold on to.
Instead of heaven. Are you trying to impress? Running around trying to help this girl?
Just trying to help her, Mum.
You better go. How come you're not with her?
I've messed a lot of things up, Grace.
There's still time.
I just hope you're all keeping safe out there. You're surrounded by your families.
Hold on. Hold on, Grace.
It's coming.
Pretty sure this was straight to video, right, Phil?
Yes, yes. These Final Hours, it had a limited release in Australia a couple of years ago, but it came to the States and pretty much the rest of the world starting in May of 2015. So it's straight to VOD basically everywhere, except for a limited release that happened in Australia a couple of years ago, and it did play one of the midnight events at Cannes also, otherwise VOD. And you said correctly, Eric, it's an Australian film. It's directed by a guy named Zach Hilditch, and he also wrote it. But it does star someone of note in the horror film community, Nathan Phillips, who was the male star of Wolf Creek. He was also one of the stars of Chernobyl Diaries, and he was also in Snakes on a Plane, as well as a pretty good horror film, Australian horror film that was part of the 8 films to die for, called Dying Breed. He was excellent in that as well. He was basically the lead on this film. The film also has a few other folks. The reason I saw it was because Netflix, it just suddenly appeared on Netflix, and it said Sarah Snook starred in it, which
that's a lie.
Which is a complete lie. She just has a small role in the film, and
but it worked. It got her attention.
Yes. But had I known Nathan Phillips, the name to the face, I would have watched it anyway, because Nathan Phillips is a pretty good actor.
Which one is Sarah Snook again?
She was the woman from Predestination. The film Predestination.
Right, okay. And was she the girlfriend?
No. She was
Mandy's mom is the character's title.
If that makes any sense.
Okay.
In other words, she was the woman that...
At the party
that said, you look like my daughter.
Oh, right. Okay.
And we'll discuss that when we get to that. The film, again, 2013 production, 2014 at the Cannes Midnight Festival, and then 2015 to the U.S. of A. And it is what we would call a post-apocalyptic or about to be a post-apocalyptic type film.
I was going
to
say, I think it's impending apocalyptic.
Well, yeah. You know what? Yeah. Actually, it's an ongoing apocalypse.
Yeah,
because most of the world is going, the world is being destroyed over the course of the film. It's just that Australia got in the back of the line.
True. <Yep. laughs> And thus the title, These Final Hours.
Right, and we'll discuss why Australia is one of the last places to be hit by the apocalypse, and might as well just say it now, is basically a meteor hits near Western Europe, and basically the explosion is like a giant nuclear bomb, and it's slowly traveling throughout the world, and eventually will come to everywhere on the world in 12 hours till it hits Australia. So the film is basically a 12-hour process, is basically what the film is. And before we get into the topic and the synopsis and all that, I saw it. I found out about it through Netflix. It just appeared one day, and I saw the name Sarah Snook, like her as an actress from Predestination, a film we reviewed earlier this year. And so I decided to watch it. And again, that was false advertising, because she was in the film for like maybe 5 minutes. And the real star, if you look on posters and wiki and IMDb and all that, is Nathan Phillips and a girl named Angourie Rice, which is like a young actress, maybe 10 to 12 years old. So, Eric, let me ask you, because when I posted I had seen this on Facebook, you suddenly said, oh, yeah, I saw that too. How did you find out about this film, and what was your thoughts?
I ran across it on Netflix as well. I hesitated pulling the trigger on watching it for a while because I was like, that could go either way. And then I heard some people on Facebook saying positive things about it, so I decided to check it out and was pleasantly surprised. I enjoyed the movie.
Very good, very good. So you hadn't heard anything about this film until you saw it just appear on Netflix, right?
Yep.
All right, very well. I'll go next, even though I did explain how I found it just appeared on Netflix. My opinion of the film was, I thought this was a fantastic film, possibly one of the best films of the year. I think it may be my second favorite genre film of 2015. It, to me, is like last year's Come Back to Me, where this unknown film that I didn't know anything about, and it just appeared on Netflix, and I just say, watch the first 10 minutes, see if it's any good, and sure enough, it's not just good. In my opinion, it's one of the best films of 2015 so far for genre pictures. And that's a high stakes because, you know, obviously there's people going to say Jurassic World and Mad Max and so on and so forth. Ex Machina or Ex Machina and various other films, It Follows and whatnot. And, I think this film is the second best film after It Follows. What about you, Mike? How did you hear about it? What's your thoughts?
I had it on my Netflix queue list. You told me to watch it for this week. You had mentioned it earlier. It was on my Netflix queue. I don't know how it got there. So I don't know if I put it on there after you told me to, or after you talked about it, or if it was something that Netflix says, since you watched this, you'll enjoy that. You know, whatever it was. So it popped up there. So basically I watched it for this, and I literally finished watching it about 10 minutes before we started talking, because I've been spending most of the last few days when I'm not working sleeping, except for going to finally see The Visit. And so I managed to stay awake long enough, well, not entirely, to watch it, because I had a hard time when I got home staying awake to watch the first, like, 30 minutes. And that has nothing to do with...
Because you're sick, right?
The film. It has to do with the fact that I've been having trouble breathing for 4 or 5 days now.
I need oxygen,
Yeah, I know. These damn aerobic organisms. My freaking mitochondria are screaming at me. There was some stuff I was a little fuzzy on, because I thought, and I didn't have time to rewind and, like, rewatch the first half hour. I think it's a good film. I don't, like I said, I'm not in a great position to judge it right now. I could talk a little bit about it. But I certainly enjoyed it and would certainly recommend it. And it's a weirdly uplifting apocalyptic film, if that makes any sense.
It does.
And so it's like, it's not a horror film. And it is an apocalyptic drama.
It does have some horrific elements, though, I'll tell you that.
It does have some dark, it has dark stuff in it for dark discussions. But other than the fact that everybody dies horribly at the end, it's actually
it's really ends on quite a positive message.
Yeah, it's kind of a positive film. It just reminds me of when I saw, it was probably one of those dinosaur documentaries, and they talked about, you know, the big explosion at the Yucatan Peninsula when the meteor hit, and described how you'd get the shock wave and the sudden blast and heat in the atmosphere, and just thinking, my God, that had to be a really sucky way to die. And they turned it into a movie.
I know, all those poor dinosaurs.
The only ones I feel worse for.
I can't even handle that when I see that on documentaries. I go, oh my God, they're all dying.
The ones I feel worse for are the ones that live through it.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, at least when you're caught in the heat wave, it's over.
Yeah. It's global, so everybody was caught in it. But yeah, it was bad. So it's the same sort of, and it is. It's one of these things like, nope, don't matter where you go. You're fucked.
There's actually a scene in it that discusses that, because there's a bomb shelter scene, and we'll get into that as well. Yeah. All right, very good. What about you, Abe? What did you hear about the film, and what's your thoughts?
I heard from you, Phil. You sent me a text one day telling me it would be a film we've seen on Netflix. And honestly, the title kind of gave away what kind of film it would be, but onto that point, I didn't realize the film existed or was on Netflix to begin with. So it was actually the first time I knew about it. It's funny because we've seen a lot of horror flicks this year so far, but this has to be one of the most bleakest films because of its tone. It's a very grim film because of you know the conclusion that we are approaching. You know, there's no like oil drill is to save the day or some kind of science figuring out something. It's a done deal with this impact event. And it's more of a coming of age story, a human drama, and one character's maturation and growth within 12 hours. So it's a big, big change. And I really liked it. thought it was a very well made film. It was shot well. It had, as I said, it had a great atmosphere. The acting was great throughout. It really gave, and I did love how it, all of its grim scenes were not like overdone. Cause that could have easily gone that direction. It could have been just really, and it being very cheesy or just ridiculous. I expected such scenes like the rave party he heads to, stuff like that. But, those kind of, the chaos is not really what's the focus. Cause most of the scenes are very, quiet, dialogue heavy scenes between characters. And it's more about how they're dealing with their impending death and trying to reconcile with family or friends. And it's, I don't know. I mean, it's a strong contender for a top 10, for at least on my end.
All right, excellent. Very well. And Chrissy, where did you hear about the film, and what's your thoughts?
Well, I actually heard about it from Eric when we were taping Stakeland, and he mentioned it. And then I called my sister because I had written it down. I remember going, oh, my God, this sounds like a movie I need to see. So I was talking to my sister about it because she sees a lot more movies than I do, if you can believe that. And she was like, okay, yes, I was going to recommend that to you, but I think it's going to really affect you on a deeply personal level because it's, you have this thing about fire and this terrible fear of dying in fire and all this. So I never recommended it to you. She said, but I also think it's a giant metaphor for kind of like what we went through as kids and you're going to kind of whatever. So I was like, all right. So it was interesting because when you messaged me, Phil, I had already seen it.
Oh, very good.
Because she was like, yeah, it's going to disturb you. I found this film incredibly disturbing in all the right ways that I like to be disturbed. Like I could totally identify with things on a very deep level that's kind of very personal. I thought that the acting was amazing. I thought the desolation, the atmosphere, I also have to agree with Abe. This was really a growth story. It was this character's journey. It was a perfect example of character conflict, crisis, change. So since I had already seen it, when you messaged me, I started looking into other types of films that were sort of like this. Of course, it's been compared to The Last Wave, which I don't know if you guys have seen the Peter Weir film, The Last Wave. Anybody ever seen that?
Nope.
Oh, my God. If you like this, you need to see that. That's a 70s film. We'll talk about that later. But, yeah, so I love it. I can't recommend it enough. I think it's an amazing film. But I think it's not for the faint of heart. If you are disturbed by the idea of your own impending death or the hopelessness, there's a wonderful sense of desperation in this. If that stuff is going to disturb you to your core and you enjoy being disturbed to your core like that, then absolutely see it. If not, then don't because I'm still having active nightmares. Like I'm not sleeping because of it, which I think is awesome because there are very few films that affect me that way on such a soul level. It's not even about being scary. It's just so powerful. And I have to agree with the rest of you or whoever it was, or a couple of you said it. This would definitely be on my top 10. Absolutely.
I do have to warn that the impending apocalypse apparently does turn some people into whiny bitches. I just...
Okay. That's to be expected, though.
Yeah.
You know what? Pretty much every situation turned some people into whiny bitches.
That is true, yes.
Well, it's interesting because the whole core of the film is sort of like, I was reading an interview with the director, and there's this podcast I was listening to, actually, which was out of Australia, where the guy kind of went into depth about it, so I'll talk about that a little later. But he said, really, the core theme of this film is, what are you going to do when absolutely in 12 hours, nothing's going to matter anymore?
Right.
Nothing is going to matter. And from that opening scene, we get that. You know, nobody cares. So.
Right, right. Well, and it's interesting, too, how all the players in this film act from the criminals to the people who says, well, we might as well just party until we're gone, to the quiet contemplation of doing a puzzle, all the way to someone such as our lead character who doesn't know exactly what he wants to do and then is put into a situation or a journey that he has to do because of the type of human being he really is when he meets the little girl and saves her, which we will discuss shortly. No. But the most important thing is that we discussed how this film could be so many different, a journey of a person and its growth and whatever. I also saw a biblical thing such as the prodigal son where.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because the character was like a prodigal son, and yet, in the eyes of quote unquote God, or whatever he, or him being the prodigal son, never mind the character in this movie, is all but forgiven for sins because he has never wavered from the truth, which is dignity and human sacrifice and so on and so forth.
Well, and before we get into one other thing, I did just want to mention this for you guys who liked the film and for the listeners who are interested. They did some very interesting marketing for this film. There's a YouTube channel. You have to look to find it. But it actually has videos that shows bits and pieces, like random newscasts, Skype videos of people calling for help while rioting is happening outside their apartments. There are press conferences with the leader of Australia. I think, do they have a prime minister in Australia?
They do.
I think so.
Yes,
they do?
They do.
Yeah.
Yes, they do.
They have an outline of a plan 5 months before where they notice the asteroid and they're going to try to hit it with nukes. Which obviously doesn't work.
Because they didn't send Bruce Willis to drill them
in. Yeah, there is also, there's an interactive experience called The Countdown, which is like an online game.
Countdown.
Yep. It's an online game that you can go and play, which I actually tried, which is really fun, about how you're going to quote, try to survive, end quote. And the things that keep happening to you. So you have to make the choices or different choices in what's presented to you. And it's on a much deeper level than like a Walking Dead game would be. And that's all online. So you just got to Google around and find it. I didn't write down the links, but it was all out there. And I spent a lot of time watching all of these different videos. Fascinating. So they did a lot of heavy marketing in Australia. And if anybody loves this film as much as I did, go Google around and find that stuff. Cause there's a lot more. There's almost 2 hours of footage that they put together on YouTube that happens well before we get to the 12-hour point, before the movie even opens. So
interesting.
It's out there. If any of you guys want to check it out, it's kind of cool.
Now Eric, you were about to say something.
I was just about to ask a question because I did watch this for a second time tonight right before the podcast, and I still missed something. Although I think maybe I didn't miss it. Maybe they never explicitly stated it in the movie, which is that at the beginning of the movie, our main character, James, is with a woman, and I don't think they ever explicitly state what his relationship is with that woman. Does anybody know?
I guess it's just a lover, another lover or something like that.
Yeah, basically, the idea is that he's the quote-unquote prodigal son, meaning he is a womanizer and various other things, and so he's banging this broad here. And yes, I did say broad.
Somebody has to pull a sound clip of Phil saying, banging this broad.
Yes, sorry about that. And while being with another woman as well. So he's basically dating two women in a sense. And
so it wasn't a wife or anything, just another girlfriend?
That's right, exactly.
Okay, all right.
And I think the most important lesson in the whole film, of course, though, is that if you're a guy and you got a pregnant woman at home and you got a party you want to go to and you ask her if you could go to the party and she says she's staying home, but you can go if you want to, Don't go. Don't go. It's a trap. It doesn't matter if the world's ending. Actually, that makes it worse. You're only going to get in trouble later. Stay home.
Oh, and, see, I don't know. We don't ask each other what we want to do in our house. We just tell each other, and it works out fine. So I don't understand what all this issue is, but whatever.
Well, basically what it is the whole film takes place in the suburbs of the huge Western Australia city of Perth. And what it is he and her, this girl that he's with, Zoe, the one that we meet at the beginning of the film, she says that she's pregnant. She just found out that she's pregnant. And he gets all flustered about it because he knows in 12 hours from now he's dead when the meteor explosion eventually hits Australia. And he wanted to basically party the last 12 hours of his life, you know, be happy or try to be happy. And suddenly he's now weighted down with the fact that he was going to be a father. And so a melancholy sets in and he like freaks out. And she says, you should just go to the party then if it's really that important to you. And he goes, yeah, I want to, because I just don't want to think of anything about my impending doom.
But Philip, that's what's interesting about that opening scene, because they don't show you the entire conversation. She tells him, right, that she's pregnant in flashback.
Right.
So in the opening scene, he looks like not as much of an ass, which is, no, he doesn't, because he's leaving his girlfriend to go to this giant party, and a lot of the reviews and descriptions that before I watched the movie noted that he was this self-obsessed character, and it was kind of expressed in a very negative way. But in that opening scene, because she doesn't tell him that she's pregnant, and we as the viewers don't get to see that, I didn't dislike him at all. I understood him because he says that dying is going to hurt, and he doesn't want to feel dying. And that's very human, and we can all relate to that. So I think it was kind of a smart move to open without showing that whole pregnancy thing until later, after we got to know him a little bit, because we don't see that until after he rescues the girl.
Right.
We feel sympathy and empathy because we're like, yeah, we understand it. You know, it's like, hey, I wouldn't want to feel that pain either. But that line, interestingly enough, is basically a metaphor for the emotional journey that he goes on, because we can see through the whole film that the whole reason he's a druggie and a partier and for all intents and purposes a loser is because he doesn't want to feel anything. He never wanted to feel anything for whatever reason. We're never really given the reason for that.
Yeah, in a way, he was comfortably numb in a way.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
Yeah, well, and to be honest, we do get minor pieces as we go, but not anything specific. But it appears that his family is a little maybe dysfunctional, but not much. No more dysfunctional than, I guess, most people's families. But again, we're talking about, you know, the young rebel who doesn't want to be part of the machine or whatever. So he chooses to be a partier or whatever and quote-unquote, as you said, Chrissy, a bum or a loser, when in reality he probably isn't. It's just that he chose that way because of the fight against the machine or the fight against the picket fence and all this other crap that he wants to avoid as much as possible because of who knows why. I mean, like you said, we don't really know. We only have we just land up in this guy's middle of his story right as we discover the world is about to go.
Right. I actually have a little sympathy for the character in that situation. And, I mean, I'm not a partier. The last place on Earth I would want to be the last place on Earth would be at a party. I am a completely different bummer loser than this bummer loser.
I'd be at a party playing Russian roulette. That scene was awesome.
Right. But I can understand, like, you know, now you tell me now that you know, that you're pregnant. What good did that do? And right. And the first instinct for most people, or maybe I'm just a selfish bastard, is often is like, oh, fuck, you know, how does this affect me? Right? What does this mean in my life? And then you stop and, well, what about other people? But, right, it's like, now you tell me this now. And have to know, and it makes me think of that scene in Seven, right, where Morgan Freeman says, you know, if you decide to have the abortion, right. Don't ever tell him.
Right.
Right.
Right. And that's something, as a man, that a man would never, can't understand, and that is that a woman in that position of, would you tell the end of the world? I mean, you can't play that game with a guy. Okay, you're pregnant. The end of the world's coming. Do you tell the wife? What? You know, we can't. We can't
I want to tell the tabloids.
Well, yeah, I think
we can't. We can't put ourselves there. And so I don't know. So, and I think there's probably just as interesting a story about her. You know, in a way, in terms of what she had to go through to figure out to tell him.
Yeah.
You know why, and you know. I'm hoping she thought he would be less of an ass about it.
Well, that was kind right. of my, I think that whole discussion where she does tell him only at the end of the world made sense for me. It filled in so much about her character because she loved him anyway. Like she knew under normal circumstances, if she told him that, he was probably going to take off. She knew that. And so she figured, what the hell, we're going to die anyway. This is where I'm going to tell him. I got the sense she was probably one of those women that would have been like, if the world was not ending, I'm going to tell him. And if he leaves me, it's okay. He's just going to get a letter after I'm dead saying, hi, you've got a kid here somewhere, you know, or maybe she wasn't going to tell him at all. I never got the sense she was going to commit an abortion. I mean, did not commit.
Well, no, not that, but I'm saying it's the, she's not going to, she doesn't have to. That really would be a waste of money at that point. But it's the fact that she's pregnant. She knows she's pregnant. Maybe she was going to tell him. Maybe she wasn't. Maybe she was deciding. But it's, oh, I want him to know before he dies that he's a father. And there's something I can understand from her perspective why she might share that. Because, you know, thinking, because she also has to, she's going to suffer that, right? That she has to know that not only is she dying, but her baby is dying with her. Right, because right. The mother has that relationship with the child before the father does, and in a very different way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And,
well, and yep. there's two other things that are related to that, too. One is somewhat what Chrissy mentioned about, you know, would he stick around if it wasn't the end of the world or whatnot. And, you know, that's possible that he wouldn't stick around. But as we discover... maybe he would, based off of what we find out and his relationship with the girl that he saves later in the film, the little girl that he saves later in the film. But the other thing that's interesting, too, is that if there's only 12 hours left, nothing really matters anymore. So, like, you know, we see people killing people. We see people having sex and drugs. We see people just wasting their last 12 hours by doing puzzles, if you want to call that wasting, and whatnot and whatnot. So does it really matter? Because in 12 hours, nothing exists anymore anyway. So who cares? But as we discover, as this guy goes through his 12-hour journey, things do matter. And those things do matter. Even if everything will be gone in 12 hours, the here and now, it still matters. Because he wants to help the little girl. He wants to get her to, quote-unquote, her family or whatnot. He does want to get back to this woman here that we meet at the beginning of the movie, Zoe, because it still matters. So, in other words, life still matters, or perception just being still matters, even if 12 hours from now it's gone.
Pretty much, it's a matter of, it's not over till it's over.
Right, and it's, as humans, you know, we're not rational beings. The rational being would say, it doesn't matter. Right? They would be able to disconnect from that stuff. But we are emotional creatures, and we have a sense of things beyond, you know, necessarily that immediate physical thing, and that there's stuff that matters to us on principle, right? And, you know, that, well, I don't care if it's the last thing I do before I die and I'll never get to enjoy it. It's, that's the way I'm going out. That matters to us. You know, this idea, what do you call, whether you want to call it your, you know, your, it could be your spirituality or your honor or these intangible qualities that matter to us. And, you know, whether, you know, and some people it's a religious component, but how we live our life matters as much as anything else besides just the fact that we lived a life.
And I agree with that, Mike, because in this 12 hours, we see people who snap and murder people. We see people who don't snap and still want to do bad things and murder people and rape. And in that 12 hours, if you believe in, quote unquote, you know, the Judeo-Christian God, you could actually determine whether you're going to hell or not based off of those 12 hours. So this guy here, our lead, can oddly, if we look at it that way, can save himself by his actions these last 12 hours, while, you know, the guy with the machete that we see, or the rapists, they choose, you know, they could have been, you know, normal people or nice people right before they knew that everybody was going to die, and then yet they choose in that 12 hours to be murderers and rapists, and suddenly, boom, their soul is, you know, is lost.
Well, and also there's that conversation that he and Zoe have that doesn't he guess it's a little girl? Right?
Yeah.
And then he meets the little girl. So it's almost like he gets that opportunity to be somewhat of a father in that last 12 hours. Yeah. In another way, which is not only redeeming himself, but he gets to go and live out that kind of fantasy.
So he actually gains a sense of responsibility by taking care of her.
Absolutely.
He doesn't, you know, because he doesn't have to, but he does. You know, he puts himself at risk numerous times to protect this girl, get her to that destination. Even though in 12 hours, both of them will be annihilated. Everything will be gone.
Yeah.
And he matures. Most of the time when we first meet him, he's very uptight, he's very aggressive, he's just kind of distant, just detached through everything. But then he grows a conscience, and also he begins to smile more and opens up to not just her, but even his mother, who I guess they haven't seen each other in a long time. To the point where the mother at one point said she had said goodbye to him way before this had happened.
Yeah, that scene was very sad.
And, well, that's the thing. It's that, you know, she basically, the mother, you know, that's he's the prodigal son. And then, you know, she takes him back after, you know, their little discussion and whatnot. And then, as you said, Abe and Chrissy, about him becoming like a father figure to this little girl. And the interesting thing where two people who meet in such a situation, and we've seen it in other films and scenarios, and I forget specifics, but they become a pair or they become together. I mean, actually, you know where one of them I saw is that Walking Dead game, Mike, where the
with
criminal...
With Lee and... I can't think of her name.
And the little girl, whatever her name is. But in that game, two people who have nothing to do with each other meet up. And then he becomes the father figure, and she becomes the follower or the daughter. And even though they're not related and they've only known each other for a short time, they no matter who enters the picture, the girl is always going to be with him, and he's always going to be with the girl. And that's what happens in this movie, because, you know, we're at the party, at points at the very beginning of the film, tries to dump her off on other people, and yet she still wants to stay with him no matter what, because she thinks he'll bring her to her family. And then at points when she thinks he's abandoned, then she may switch allegiances and whatnot. But all in all, they always land back together. And I think that's part of what the film's trying to say about the father-daughter relationship that they have, where they may drift at points, but they're always going to be back together. And then I like what you said, Abe, about how he opens up, because there's a great scene in the car where he says to her that you're a power chick or a strong chick or something like that. And he says, "You didn't say it loud enough. Say it again." And she goes, "I'm a strong chick." And they laugh and they giggle. And it's a very heartwarming scene between the two.
Well, there's a lot. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say there's one of the themes in this film, I think, is communication between individuals. Like you were saying, people who never met each other, they hook up. There's a big theme. And it's also a motif. The theme would be communication. I think the motif would be messages. There's messages all through this film, like literal ones. Like Hilditch was careful to put all kinds of spray-painted messages, notes, things that are left, like Susan, come home. There was one that said, fuck off. There was one that said, sorry, had to leave. That's where we see the body hanging from the
light post.
The light post.
Oh, that was such an effective image.
Oh, my God. That was so effective. Yeah. And trespassers will bleed before they die, which also has a whole, like, metaphorical implication about this is the end of the world. You're going to basically – all of your ugliness is going to bleed out of you because, you know. So that was a very heavy, I think, symbol, motif, conceit. I almost want to say it was conceit because it was all the way through, except the balance was a little off at the end. But it was kind of like messages. It was one of the themes in this film was how we communicate and how our communication changes based on our environment.
Well, so. let me ask you this, Chrissy. A lot of times I'm going to ask Mike this question too, which Mike, you can chip in. But I know, like you said, you were under the weather a little bit when you're watching the film. But Chrissy, you probably would get it right away. But speaking of communication and speaking of the guy hanging from the light post and all these other things, did you notice in this film, the film continuously over and over and over and over shows electrical and telephone wires everywhere?
Yes. Yeah.
And poles and substations and all these things. And I want to know your opinion. Why you think? I don't think that was just a fluke. I think it was. And I mean, a lot of directors would put it in because, oh, that's a cool image to see the silhouette of these things in the distance with a sun setting or whatnot. But I think there was more to it. What's your opinion of that?
No, there is more to it. That's the single effect theory. The single effect theory works in movies.
Explain it.
The single effect theory is basically that Edgar Allan Poe was basically the first one to put it forth. And what Poe basically posited was that every single image, every single word, every single, metaphor, color, symbol, bug, whatever. Every single thing you put in your story is supposed to work toward. It's kind of like a thesis, like a college thesis. It's supposed to support your theme or the message you're trying to get across. And that's why sometimes films are very heavy-handed, because they pound those images into your head. In this particular film, it was very subtle. You always saw the wires. You always saw, and I picked up on that right away, because then I saw the graffitied messages and I said, okay, this guy's trying to say something about communication and the way that we communicate to each other and how communication changes when we're under threat. So what you're talking about, Phil, is what would be called a visual conceit. Cause in a regular short story, you could maybe reference the telephone wires as you're writing. You might have a character notice the telephone wire, or you might have, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
But in a film, they're just going to show images of it. But it wasn't overdone. It was extremely subtle. It wasn't like, here's this telephone pole, look at it for 5 minutes. It was extremely subtle.
The only reason I even noticed it, because you're right. I mean, I watched the film a week or a half ago with my wife, and she actually liked it too. And I didn't notice it as much. And then when I rewatched it yesterday, I noticed it more, and I also thought the movie was even better the second time watching it. But the main reason I noticed it was because when I was making the collage for the episode that we're going to put out, a lot of the pictures of the in the film have all the stuff in the background, these poles and substations and whatnot. And so I was like, oh, this is interesting, and it makes sense. What you say about, you know, people communication and whatnot, and probably the intention of the writer director, who is actually the same person. Now, Eric, what was your opinion of the cool idea? Because he has more communication of to get the backstory of the film and how close we are to death, having a radio announcer in the car.
I liked it. Because I could totally picture this guy by himself in the booth at the radio station. At that point, phone lines are probably down, and nobody could really call each other anymore. So he doesn't know if anybody's listening, but just in case, he's going to sit there and talk until it's done. And I thought that was a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, it was almost like his way of for the last 12 hours. And, you know, some people it's like to get to their families. Other people it's to party. Other people it's to do mayhem. And then this guy is, I'm going to do my job until the very end because that's what I do. And and it was cool too because it allowed us, the viewers, to see what was going on. Like Europe is now gone, the United States is gone, Mexico is now dead, whatever. And we're learning all this. Thailand, my brother was in Thailand.
Oh my God, that was so sad when he goes, my brother is gone.
Yeah, yeah, and that's
was
how,
and he says, I hope he was somewhere beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I started bawling. That was so sad.
Yeah, it was a second character haven't seen going through his own dilemma, you know? Well, it's giving us some backstory and just the development as we begin. Because he's pretty much, as we continue through the film, he's announcing the countdown as we get closer to the finale.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. The fireball that's coming to Australia. He's basically discussing it and giving us the details. And every time our lead characters get in a car, they turn on the radio and we hear this guy, and that's how we get our backstory or exposition without having to do quote unquote exposition, because it's actually fits perfectly within the film. And I think it was a beautiful plot device by the director screenwriter, to be honest.
Well, really speaking to something true about human nature, because we all, if we're old enough, we all have people that at one point in our time were an important part of our lives, and we kind of go our separate ways, and you may not, it's easy to lose track for a while, right? And if you never heard from that person again, you'll think of them from time to time. If you never heard from them again, you might not think anything of it. But if you hear they died, knowing that the person had died, it hits you in a different way, right? Does that, you get what I'm saying?
Oh yeah.
Here's his brother. His brother's in Thailand, and maybe he had nothing to do with his brother. Maybe they hadn't spoken in 10 years. I'm gonna get to it. But his life really, if he hadn't been told his brother died or hadn't realized his brother's died, his life wouldn't have been any different. But again, getting back to that, there's more to us than just the practical reality. Once you have the knowledge that door is closed forever, it still hits you and it still changes you, and still impacts you, even though if that person maybe hasn't been there for a while. But
you're absolutely right, Mike. Because there's a short story by the author Joe Netter that's kind of like that. But what it is basically what you're saying is that someone that was really important in your life and whatnot, and then you drift apart for whatever reason, you move across the country or you stay quit their job and so you don't see them every day like you used to or whatever. And they move, you move to a different town and they were your neighbor or something. And then suddenly you hear that they pass away or they're sick or something. And it sometimes affects you more than, say, if it happened as you see it every day, my mother, her passing, I saw her slowly go, or my grandfather from Alzheimer's or whatnot. But it wasn't, it would have been probably more, no matter how depressing it is that I lost both of them, it could have been worse had, like you said, Mike, if say, I lived in Oklahoma and the family were here and stuff. So yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Well, we just had a lost a teacher from cancer. But she had been in full remission. She had retired in June.
Yeah.
For most of the school and most of her students, she was probably, you know, especially for most of the students, she was probably somebody they wouldn't see again.
Sure.
Although I guess now I may be discounting Facebook and technology too much, but I don't know if she was heavily into the internet and stuff. But still, I mean, it had a huge impact on the school. Again, we're going beyond the practical. And what I like what you see about the radio announcer. It's a good device, but I think it also speaks to, I think I may have mentioned the podcast before, but I remember around the time for 9/11, or maybe on one of the various memorials, somebody saying, you know, that you heard all these stories about what was going on in the Twin Towers and what people were doing. And someone said that, you know, what people were doing there, how they lived in the towers at those last moments, you know, a lot of that's who they were. If you were the person shoving people out of the way and pushing the old lady down to get down the stairs, or if you were the person helping the old lady up, you know, that's how you died. That's who you were. You know, that's who your character is. And there's something when you have a situation like this, if you're the guy who's having a party and playing Russian roulette, that's who you are. If you're the person sitting home playing puzzles or making puzzles, that's something about who you are. And if you've lived your life behind a microphone, then that's the way you're going out.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something to be said. And it was interesting because when I was, you know, I've since pulled the Peter Weir film, The Last Wave, and I recommend that all of you watch it. If you like these final hours, you're really going to enjoy this film. I saw it years ago. I pulled it because I want to watch it again. I didn't get a chance to watch it again before tonight, which I really kind of wanted to do because I'm sure I would have seen the similarities. But when Peter Weir did that film, the question that – and I watched an interview with him. He said – the whole question was, what if someone with a very pragmatic approach to life experienced a premonition? And that was so jarring and so questioning of what would you do at the end of your life? That's basically kind of like what the last wave is about in a metaphorical way. And so I agree with Mike because like he said, in the last moments of your life, how you act is who you really are. You know, well, that's because your true nature comes out.
Right. Well, I think all of you, you know, when you die, not me, of course, you have, there are basically two ways out. And option one is that it'll be an accident or it'll catch you unaware. And meaning, and now that might be you're 85 years old and you died in your sleep. Or it could be you step outside and you get hit by a truck. But for a lot of people, it's going to be you go to the doctor, they find something, they give you the news, and now you have a countdown. And the countdown may be
the final countdown.
Exactly. And as Europe is playing, now you may
long
get
long live Europe. Excellent band.
Right. You may get more time than what the doctor tells you, or less time than what the doctors tell you, but that's kind of putting the gun to your head and saying, you've got to think about this now. And so that's, you know, worldwide, the entire world is told from, you know, this, how long ago, you know, what was it, 4 or 5 years that they had known about the meteor coming?
Right.
Right. So that's it. The whole world is told, you've got 5 years to live. It's like the entire world was just diagnosed with cancer. Right there. Okay, it's the same basic idea, except that you don't have to go through chemo. Again, it's how are you going to react to that? And now normally if I find out I've got some terrible illness, God, I hope that doesn't come true, but if I find out I've got some terrible, I have people around me that I can hold on to and help suck some of the life out of them for strength. But if I go, oh my God, I just find out I'm dying in 5 years, And they're all going, me too! Well, how, you know, are we going to be supporting each other, or are we just going to, you know, spiral out of control into a mess?
And, well, and that's a lot why of that's, I loved, I'm sorry, go ahead, finish.
No, I think a lot of that's, again, reflecting how people react, and who's the ones playing Russian roulette, who is off on their own, who's living responsibly, but.
Well, that's why I love that opening scene, which was a total shocker, where the crazy guy gets in the car, and he's got a machete, yeah. And then he goes, drive me to this whatever, and we don't know what the backstory is, but he sees this guy walking up the driveway, and he leaps out of the car and just starts hacking him to death with this machete. And all I'm thinking was like, oh my God, what did that guy do to him? Like, it was obviously his neighbor.
But or was, something. Or maybe something. He was or the bully in school who took a shit in his locker or whatever.
Or his boss or who knows.
Yeah, yeah. Just awesome. But that was such a shocker. I just sat there going, holy shit. Like, oh my God.
I love the fact that then the guy runs away. He's like, hey, get back here. You know, it's, I'm going to hang around with crazy machete guy.
That was the thing. Crazy machete guy was always crazy machete guy.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you're saying, Mike, is that, finally, crazy machete guy was allowed under the auspices of the apocalypse.
Allowed, finally allowed to express himself.
Exactly, the person he was meant to be.
Yeah, I think
as horrible as it is.
What we can take away from it is that a lot of the people we've seen these acts of debauchery, cruelty, and stuff have been hiding on this facade. They've been wearing this mask until. All laws and all order don't matter anymore because in 12 hours, it's gone. So at that point, they can be what they want to be at that point. The rapists, that crazy machete guy, the partiers, they can revel in their deepest desires because there's no one going to stop them because they're all dealing with their own problems.
Well, I also want to, if we don't look at it as so deep, even though 90% of everything you guys said is 100% accurate, I would also like to say that the 10% of the folks that are partying and boozing it up and having sex or whatever, they're trying to do what our lead character originally wanted to do, which is just try to avoid the reality of the situation, which is I'm dead in whatever amount of hours. So some of these... Yeah, go on, Eric. Yeah, please.
Sorry, I was just going to say there's a great representation of that when we get to the bunker scene.
Yeah.
Let's talk about – there's two scenes of
interest. Well, I was going to say I think something that matters here with this whole conversation is that it's not we're all dying in 5 hours or 2 hours or however long is left.
Yeah, it's 12 hours.
It's that, right, but it's – well, as the film progresses and we get closer and closer.
That's fair.
It's that you're going to die horribly.
Right.
Okay, this is not going to be an easy death. This is not going to be, and everybody will go to sleep, and then it will all be over. It will be, you'll slowly roast alive.
Right.
And this gets to, like, the debates we have over euthanasia, right? Should people be able to end their lives if they have a terminal illness or if they're suffering? You know, do they have a right to that? And do other people assist? And all, and so you see a lot of people, they have that on the radio announcer saying it's all perfectly okay if you choose to opt out. Right?
Yeah, he says if you choose to check out early, there's no shame in that.
Yeah, there's no shame
in that.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah, but we also know that there are people, and I'm trying not to get in one side or the other. There are some people who would have a problem with that. And there are some people who will say there is shame in calling it quits. And these are the people who do oppose legalizing euthanasia. And I think there are valid arguments on either side, and a lot has to do with how you perceive life. And,
Mike, and it's also the Judeo-Christian, which is suicide is a sin, right?
Right, but that has to go again. It's what's your feedback, you know, how are you perceiving it from all these influences in your life? And, you know, you said that we're finally allowed to be who we are. And there's always questions even then about, well, who are we really? You know, you have the Rousseau idea that we're all, you know, we're the noble savage and society makes us bad. And then you get the other side that says, you know, that we're all born savages and we have to be taught not to be shitheads. And there is some truth to both. There's a book that just came out called Children of Monsters that's about 20 children of dictators. So like the children of Stalin and the children of Mussolini and the children of Saddam Hussein and
Gaddafi and on and on.
And Gaddafi and the Ayatollah Khomeini. And, you know, some of them you get like the worst of the worst, like Uday Hussein, who is absolutely horrendous. And then you get others that are just trying to live without being known. I think it's Ceausescu's son, someone who's basically works in a university somewhere, doesn't want anyone to know who he is, doesn't want to have to deal with it, you know, and it just, it gets that fascinating argument about the nature or nurture. And because obviously if you're raised by a dictator who's got unlimited power, you basically have a lot of your, there's a good chance you're having a lot of those blocks that stop you, your id from just shitting on everything.
Right. Never mind the genetics.
Right. Never mind the genetics part of it. Those are removed, and sometimes it's not. You know, why will some people, you know, that's an old saying is that every generation, civilization is threatened by an oncoming horde of barbarians, and we call those children.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's our job to civilize them. And that's one perspective of human nature, where others, they're all little angels. They're adorable, loving little beings, and we just need to protect them from the corruption of their world, and they'll grow up to be perfect. And you may get an idea which side I tend to agree with. But it's...
Mike, you're 100% right. The side you're on is correct.
Yeah. Well, you see it that way. And like,
Magnolia, I always quote the scene from Magnolia. Don't ever mistake children for angels.
How old's Colette now?
She's two.
Oh, she's not talking yet, right?
Well, we got the terrible twos coming, man. They're terrible twos, and they're already beginning.
Well, you I want to know, you know, when you first catch her in a lie, right? Are you going to have to teach her how to lie? No, we all figured that shit out on our own. Did you take the cookie? No! With crumbs all over your mouth, chocolate all over your hands, and half a cookie at your foot. But no, I didn't take the cookie.
Louis C.K. actually does a very funny bit about that because he's talking about his daughters lying to him. And he's like, and telling them not to lie is really hard because how do you convince somebody to not use the method that pretty much can solve all of your problems?
Well, and it's not only that, but parents, let's be honest, don't lie. Don't lie to me. I'm your parent. You don't lie to me. I lie to you. That's how that works. Santa's real. You know, it's mommy has a headache, whatever. I remember being in Toys R Us and a mom's yelling, telling her kid, no, store's closing. We got to go. It's 3 o'clock on a Monday. But they're closing the store.
People most often lie to themselves, and that's what I wanted to talk about at the bunker scene.
Yeah, okay. Because there's a few scenes, the bunker scene and the scene where he goes to his mother's house.
And he lies about the sister killing herself.
Yeah. So let's talk about those scenes. But before we get into those scenes, I just want to say in a few seconds here, the thing that's great about this film and why I could rewatch this film over and over and over and never get bored of it is that it's smooth. It's so smooth. There's no scene in the film that I go, oh, that's right, that scene's in the film, and it's gonna. I got to go through that for 12 minutes, and I don't want to. So I don't. I'm gonna put the DVD back and not watch it. This film doesn't have any of those scenes. This film, it's just great from the beginning to end, at least in my opinion. So if I wanted to rewatch it, there's nothing that's gonna make me say, oh, I don't want to rewatch this again because of that one scene that's gonna bother me, because it doesn't have it. The only reason anybody wouldn't want to rewatch it is because, that's the main thing. Yeah.
Well, and it's I think it's also really tight, Phil, because there was an article in The Guardian that had talked about the new wave of Aussie science fiction, And that podcast I was listening to is called The Martian Podcast. And that's a gentleman out of Australia. His name is Terry Frost. And he's very learned about film, and I would recommend it to all of you. It's a wonderful podcast. And he concentrates a lot on Australian film, which is really nice because it's something that we don't get a lot on our USA-based podcasts. He talks about a lot of obscure things that we've probably never heard of or whatever. But there was an article in The Guardian that talked about Australian films are embracing science fiction, but they're embracing it like this film, but they're embracing it in a different way because they don't have the same system of funding that we do here in the United States.
Right, right.
So they don't have budgets for special effects. They don't have budgets for, you know, there's still a lot of practical stuff, like where they still really just blow up a cheap car, you know, because they only have, you know, $20,000 to blow up a car. And this guy on the Martian, Terry Frost, was saying on the Martian podcast, that's what he believes makes the apocalyptic films of Australia, which there have been a rash of them lately, apparently, so popular because they focus more on the human aspect rather than the special effect aspect. Where here in the United States, you know, we're dealing with Armageddon, right, where Bruce Willis goes and blows up the thing. We've already referenced that a couple times. Deep Impact, you know, Dante's
Day After
Peak,
Tomorrow.
The Day After Tomorrow, like all these.
2014 or whatever the film was called.
Yeah, whatever, 2012.
Whatever the year was.
Yeah, that other horrible thing that wasn't 2012.
Well,
what the hell was that? The one with Nicolas Cage. No.
Knowing? The Knowing.
I know what you're talking about, but I can't remember the title.
I love that. Knowing was so bad.
That was great.
No, I'm sorry. No. The last third of that film was such horseshit. I was like, are you kidding me?
Come on.
Anyway, I agree with you.
That was good.
Anyway, my point is that.
The bees! But, oh, see, Chris,
I like the bees.
Chris, that's what I always used to say, though, about at least the old school zombie movies, is that because zombies are completely without character and personality and the rules are quickly established, you can focus on the people.
Yeah.
Right? They don't have to focus on the monsters. I always thought that was one of the things that worked with before they started like getting all sappy and romantic and warm bodies and things like that. But it's, you know, that
zombies were a backdrop.
Yeah, the zombies were a backdrop and you could deal with, and I think, you know, the original Night of the Living Dead being a good example is it's the, you know, the lifeboat. The guy stuck in the house, and how do they deal with the
mist.
Crisis? Yeah, the mist, same basic idea.
Yeah.
So, you're right. I think that's a good point, is that, you know, that it does the same idea, which is the doomsday is this big overarching thing in the background. We all grasp the concept of an Armageddon. We don't care what the Armageddon is, you know, but it allows you to focus on the people.
Right, so right. Unless they lie and pretend it's a zombie show and they don't show any zombies, which pisses me off. The fucking bastards.
Yeah, I mean,
but you're not bitter.
No.
Which one are you talking? You're talking about Fear the Walking Dead?
All of them. Both of them. I don't know. Let's not even talk about that. Any Walking Dead. Okay.
Well, but Hilditch also said in an interview, I believe it was, again, I think it was in The Guardian. It might have been in somewhere else. But he did say that one of the reasons he wanted to make this film was because he wants to show that this is not a direct quote. It's kind of butchered a little bit, but he said he wanted to show that mankind was still capable of beautiful things. Now, his precursor to this, he made a short film you can find on YouTube
called
Transmissions, which kind of deals with the same.
Exactly.
Theme.
Same area it was filmed in. Yeah.
And actually what's kind of cool is that I work with a girl at work. Her name is Stella. And she was raised in Australia. Yeah, Stella. Yeah, yep. And she was raised in Australia. And she was she's always very interested in what I'm doing and podcasts and whatever. And I told her I was watching These Final Hours. She's not a genre fan. She doesn't like horror films. They scare her. And I said, listen, this, and she comes up the other day to me at work because I'm watching the movie at work. She goes, what the hell are you watching? And I said, why? She goes, because that looks like Perth, if I'm not mistaken.
And that's the city. Australia. Yeah. Yeah. That's the city.
And she goes, oh my God, really? And I'm like, yeah. And I said, well, what can you tell me about Perth? And she said, well, I haven't seen this movie. I don't plan to see this movie. But from the few images I'm kind of seeing on your computer, she's like, the director couldn't have chosen a better place because Perth is such an isolated city. She's like, yes. You are driving along for like 15 hours.
Yes.
Yeah. And then out of the desert, it's Perth.
That's right.
She's like, it just kind of shows up.
It's like Vegas. And,
yeah, exactly. And she's like, it's kind of interesting because, like, apparently, then I pulled up a map of Australia because I was really interested. And she's like, okay, well, here's where I grew up. And she pointed to some town somewhere. And she goes, okay, Perth was like 27 hours drive from me. So I'm like, okay, that's like between here and the border of Texas.
Right, right.
She's like, yeah, exactly. But the problem with Perth is that they don't, and she said Australia in general,
it's all
they don't have highways. Yeah. She goes, they don't have highways like you guys have here in America. Like, seriously. She goes, the highway they call, like, Route 27 or whatever the hell she said.
It's a two-laner.
She said it's like a two-laner. It's all dirt.
Yeah,
yeah. I was like, really? She's like, yeah. So that was kind of cool because I said, well, I would like to visit Perth. And she goes, oh, God, don't. She goes, it's a cool city. It's beautiful. But, oh, my God, you are in the middle of nowhere. And she said that's probably why the director chose to shoot it there. Because it really is in the middle of nowhere.
Well, there are two reasons. Well, there's one reason, actually. But it is, believe it or not, it is a city of 2 million people. And basically, right around the city, is, like you said, it's all desert and nothing after that. But, I think the real reason he chose that, even though it's a great location for such a film, is simply because he's actually from Perth, the director. So it's like someone being born in Vegas, seeing, oh my God, here's a city out of the middle of nowhere and the wasteland around us. Oh, we can make a movie here. So it's something like that.
Really, really, Christy, I got to say I'm a little disappointed in you.
Wow.
You know, a horror fan actually thinking it's a good idea to go visit Australia? Come on.
I've always wanted to see Australia.
You know what happens.
I know, but
from
I've always
from a distance,
wanted to see
from a safe distance.
Well, here's the thing, though. Even if you're not a horror fan, there's the every other animal down there can kill you. It's
I know.
Yeah, no, just no.
Yeah, that's what Stella said. She said, why the hell would you want to visit there? I just became a United States citizen because I don't want to live there anymore.
Hey, swallow you whole. We have plenty of fine listeners from Australia, so it's a great place.
I didn't say there's anything wrong with the people. I'm saying the animals there will fucking kill you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She was showing me animals that I had never heard of.
They will eat you, whatever. They'll kill you. So if you're going to go there, stay indoors.
Well, yeah. let's bring up a philism and talk about an important aspect of Australia, which is they have some pretty damn good looking women. And the bunker, there's a scene that we've got to
discuss. I don't think that's why Christie's going down there.
But
Stella's pretty hot. I'll give you that.
Yeah, yeah. And the bunker scene, we do meet the character of Vicky, played by Catherine Beck, and she is one fine piece. But anyway, let's talk about
that. I'm sorry. Peace?
I have to stop.
Peace?
I have to be so
anorexic, Phil. You can see every bone in her body. That's disgusting.
She is a 10. But anyway, let's
see. Phil, anyway. I have bigger boobs than she did.
A 10.
That probably says more bigger than
a lot than that. I guess if you like fucking a washboard, maybe.
A 10-inch waist, maybe.
we're talking perfect. But anyway.
Well, forget about her looks. Can we talk about her wonderful personality?
Rewind.
I've been wanting to talk about this scene for an hour now.
She was
talking about the wrong goddamn thing.
She was drunk. So her character is supposed to be drunk because of the party that she was at.
She was
so
beyond drunk. She was also strung out, too,
Yeah, so that that doesn't count. Her personality doesn't count at this point. And to be honest, she redeems herself by the end of the scene. But let's discuss this important scene and the desperation of the people and the truth about what's going to happen and there's no way out. So okay, who wants to start? Yeah, Eric, go ahead.
I just wanted to make one point about this scene in particular.
Besides how hot Vicky is?
Whatever. So along the way here, just to fast forward through the plot a little bit, our main character runs into Crazy Machete Guy who steals the keys to his car. So he gets chased away and ends up running into two other guys who kidnapped a little girl and are going to do God knows what to her. And he ends up
killing. Oh, we know what they're going to do to her. It's terrible, too.
Yes, I was not going to say it out loud, though. So he ends up rescuing a little girl and driving away, and he ends up taking a little girl to where her family was going to meet her, but they're not there.
He did kill the two people, which is interesting.
Yes. Although, once he was in the position, didn't have much of a choice.
That's true, that's true.
It was pretty much them or him at that point.
Yes.
So little girl's family isn't there, so he ends up taking her under his wing, but still continues with his plan to go to this party where he's been headed the whole time. So he shows up at this party with a little girl, which was not part of the plan, and his host is not really pleased about that.
Plus, he's strung out, too. You know.
Right. Everybody which is strung out.
Which is funny, because of all the shit that's going on, He suddenly decides, no, little girls, that's going past the limit.
Right.
Orgies, mass suicides. You know,
underage?
Oh. No, underage, no. Sorry, no good for me.
So he meets up there with his girlfriend, Vicky, which I guess is his other girlfriend.
Right.
His buddy, when he shows up, mentions that Vicky hasn't been happy to be left alone. And she starts kissing him with desperation, and really just wants to get it on. But
God bless
our him. Main character here is having a little trouble, cause he's like all thinking about the end of the world. So he's not really in the mood. And what does he say to her where she's just like, why did you tell me that?
He mentions, his sister.
Oh, yeah.
He says, my sister killed herself. I'm so bothered by this. And she's like, what the fuck? Like, I don't care.
She's like, why
would you say just that?
But this flips the table on
it. It was her whole family. Yeah.
Yeah. But she wasn't indifferent. What it was is she just didn't want to hear a downer at this point, because at this point, like everybody else at this party, just wants to try to live at least some happiness or some enjoyment.
Yeah, she says you're hassling my buzz, basically.
Exactly.
She doesn't say it that way, but she kind of, that's what
that,
she
almost says that exactly. She's really like, what's the point of me knowing that? All it can do is bring me down.
But isn't that exactly what he did to his girlfriend?
Yeah, so she basically accuses him of bringing her down, and she just wants to party. So she's sniffing more cocaine or whatever. And eventually she takes him to show him that the host has this underground bunker where they're all going to wait it out and just survive. And he's looking around the place and he's like, you're crazy. This isn't going to save you. You'd have to be so much further under the earth. He's like, you're going to bake in here.
He says 2 kilometers. You have to be at least 2 kilometers down.
Right. Whatever the fuck a kilometer is, I mean,
yeah, well, you know.
That metric system shit. Yeah.
But I don't know, Mike. Can you figure out the metrics? I can't.
So
kilometers about 2,000 miles, something. Yeah, it's
Let me get there. I'm almost there. So she says, basically, what is your fucking problem? Why can't you just let me believe this? Why can't you just let me believe I'm going to survive even if I'm not? And then she starts getting all mad at him about going off to his other girlfriend. And that's where you were, wasn't it? And there's this whole scene where she just gets mad at him, and she gets mad at him, and she gets mad at him. And then at the very end, just all the pretense gets stripped away, and she just ends up
screaming, "I don't want to die.
I don't want to die. I don't want to die." Right. And that's what everything has been about, is her trying to cover up that fear she has of dying. And I just thought that scene was so effective in the way she's trying to cover it up with the parting, and then she's just trying to cover up with bluster, and then eventually everything gets stripped away and we're down to the naked fear of death. And I just thought that was beautifully
honestly
done.
Honestly, yeah.
And the thing that was great about it too is that she was simply an hour or two behind him, is really what it came down to. Because at the point when he tells her about his sister, she's still 2 hours behind, where just trying to live the last few hours of happiness, yeah, as he was originally, because he was planning to go to the party and whatnot. And then suddenly, boom, he's shaken out of everything because he almost gets killed by the machete man. He sees a little girl that's going to be raped, and he has to save her. And then he finds his sister and her family all dead. And so all the stuff, bluster that he had or was planning to have, was gone 2 hours earlier. And so she just slowly is catching up here. And it was a wonderful scene how it occurred. Yeah. And it also shows that she isn't really the shallow human being that we thought at the beginning. What it was is she was just, you know, sad about death and what was going to happen, as everybody else probably is.
Yeah.
Go on, Abe.
And honestly, I think this extends to the host, Freddie, because
Freddie
won't believe it himself.
Freddie is Vicky's sister. So his other girlfriend, our lead character's other girlfriend, is the sister of Freddie, the host of the party.
Yeah.
So go on, Abe.
And because he wanted to show, Freddie wanted to show James the bunker. He wanted to be the one showing that, because, and you can see that there was so many, only like a handful of bunkers there, like there. He probably was going to like think like, we're going to grab a few people and go down there ourselves. No one else is going to know about it. But when, after Vicky and James have their talk about, you know, her coming to grips with her own fear, he comes down, he starts flipping out on James about, you know, blowing the good vibe and stuff like that. So you can get a feeling that he himself want to believe that this would work. That,
right.
Even though there was some part in his mind that knows that, yeah, this is just a fancy oven that I have here. This isn't going to do me any good, but I want to believe that. And the fact that James brings his logic and the painful truth to them just angered him a whole lot.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. 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 And that is, so Freddie was even behind his sister, Vicky, and by the time our lead character leaves the party, Vicky is already in the reality of what's the situation, and Freddie's still like maybe a half hour behind, I guess.
Yeah. Wait, doesn't Freddie try to kill him over that? I'm trying to remember. He pointed the gun at him.
Well, yeah, he was flipping out, and he was going to – basically what happened was that after they come out of the bunker – our lead character goes to get the little girl, and he finds the little girl being molested molested as in, you know, like kidnapping by the Sarah Snook character, who's like this druggy woman who says, "You look like my daughter. I want you to be with me when we die." And he goes to save her, and Freddie thinks he's being violent with the woman. And our lead character says, "Well, she's trying to kidnap, you know, the person I'm responsible for," and that's why Freddie is flipping out with the gun.
And I love it that Vicky shoots her.
Right,
Vicky drunk off her ass. Vicky, perfect shot, center of the head, one pull of the trigger. Don't piss her off when she's sober.
Yep, and that's her redeeming moment. That's her redeeming moment. Yeah. She goes, "Fuck you, I'm shooting you."
And she lets our lead character go, meaning she understands that he's going back to, he's trying to save this little girl and probably going back to Zoe. So she lets him go, and she also helps him in his journey of which is basically to save this little girl and bring her to her father.
Yeah, and by the time when
I'm drinking Absinthe.
Yeah,
yes, and it wasn't me, and you suck because I am been relegated to beer because there's no more wine in my house. So just you know,
well, I get something better. I'm drinking Absinthe, which is even better.
Oh, I would love to not feel my lips right now.
And what was great about the scene is like, you know, Vicky's demeanor is completely different at that point. Like. As I mentioned earlier, that term comfortably numb. She just kind of has accepted it. He's accepted his departure. He's accepted the reality of her situation. Like, I mean, because she doesn't second guess her just choice to shoot that woman at all.
No,
like, she realizes she's already dead, and she almost acts like it.
Yeah.
Like she doesn't. I mean, she has no emotion left in her.
Well, I don't know if that. I think she has emotion, which is she.
Well, we were saying she's
the acceptance stage. She's in the acceptance.
Yeah, but
stage.
She's numb at that point.
She's
numb at that point.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. If metaphorically, you're absolutely right because she's now in the reality of the situation, which is that the bunker's not going to work, and she knows she's now going to die in a few hours and whatnot.
She also realizes too that almost if you truly love someone, because in her own screwed up way, she loved James.
Oh yeah, she sure did.
You need to let them go. You need to let them go, and I think she kind of realized that where. As prior to that, she was very much about possession. Like, you brought a kid into this. How could you do this to me? And now this woman is threatening this girl, and she just blows her head off. And she's like, I'm doing this because of James, because I love James. That was kind of what I got out of it. Yeah. But.
Well, and I think it's even more than that, too. I think it's because she loves him, and she knows what's right, which is letting him go back to where he probably knows he should be, which is the woman that is pregnant, Zoe. Never mind the fact that he to save this little girl and get her to her father. So, like Mike said earlier, at this point, the true person comes out, and the true Vicky is now coming out, which is she probably is, you know, a good person. You know, obviously, probably similar to how James is. Had the world not changed, you know, kind of a drifter or whatnot, but generally still a good person, even if she is the rebel fighting against the machine or whatever, as he is, you know.
And so and there's also this whole discussion they have about where do you belong, which is also echoed in the conversations between Rose, the little girl, and James. Where do you belong at the end of the world?
Right.
Right.
Do you belong with the hedonists who are, you know, bad or whatever, or do you belong with your true self? And I think she kind of realized at that moment when she shot, you know, Mandy's mom, Sarah Snook character. I think she kind of realized that it was like, okay, I don't belong with James. I don't belong there. I belong with
her brother, Freddie.
With my crazy brother who's playing Russian roulette with other people. And that scene was very shocking to me, actually, that they were sitting there doing Russian roulette. I understood it, but I was like, oh, my God. Like, I wasn't expecting to see such a good time surrounding a game of Russian roulette.
Hey, if you're going to go out in a bank, you might as well do it literally.
Exactly. I mean, I would not – I probably would do the same thing. I would just be like, yeah, what the hell? Let's play some Russian roulette, because a fiery death to me would be much worse, you know?
But. Right. Well, this is the – we're going to die anyway. Make a game of it.
Well, and that's what the whole party
is. And even the losers win.
I mean, James sums it up perfectly to Zoe, which is, I just want to go to the party and forget the horror that's about to happen and just have a good time the last few hours I have on this earth. And James, in his eyes, this type of party is fun to him, just as his mother is what it's fun to her is to make puzzles, you know, and on. So, and I'm not disregarding, saying the quote unquote, the hedonist is bad, because it's not necessarily bad. It's how they feel and happy at that point. You know, this is how I like to go out, you know, to the nightclub, but this is how I want to live versus, oh, I like sitting at home and watch Star Trek. I mean, who cares? Whatever makes you happy, as long as it doesn't hurt other people.
So what you're saying is that a group Russian roulette in a drunken
It doesn't
festival
matter.
Orgy is the moral equivalent of sitting home making puzzles. Okay.
Absolutely, I am. Yeah, absolutely, I'm saying that. It's morally equivalent because at this point, as Christy said, you're going to be dying a horrible death. It's not like anything's going to change. It's inevitable. It's not like, oh, if we back down, the Soviets aren't going to shoot the nuke at us. There is nothing that's going to stop it. So whether you do play the puzzles or you are playing the Russian roulette, there is in no harm all in all in the long run because you're dead no matter what in this certain point of time, which is only 3 hours away anyway. So as long as you're not hurting anybody else, so what if you're doing Russian roulette or so what if you're doing a puzzle at home? So yes,
well, and that's,
so I'm going to say the hedonist is equally okay as the non-hedonist at this point in time because no one is hurting anybody.
Well, that's what was so interesting. There was one shot when he shows up at his mom's house and she says she's doing puzzles.
Well, and let's talk about that whole scene now. This is a great scene because basically he decides to go to his mother's house because the little girl has taken ecstasy because that crazy character that Sarah Snook played gave her ecstasy at the party and by bribing her, saying, I'll bring you to your father if you take this ecstasy. And so the little girl does, because, oh, you're going to take me to my father. And so she's sick to the point where she, like, kind of overdosed. So he brings the little girl to his mother's house because his mother's house is the closest. So go on, Chrissy.
Well, I was going to say, there's a shot in that scene, in the middle of that scene, I believe, where there is a fly that lands in the middle of the unfinished puzzle.
I noticed that.
Yeah, and, well, I think that was deliberately placed, and I think it was they lingered on that for a reason, or Hilditch lingered on that for a reason, because it was almost like it was a whole metaphor for humanity wandering around, trying to figure out the meaning of life, why we were here in the first place, trying to make sense of our worlds, when really our worlds are in the hands of someone else. It was resigning yourself to fate. And at the end of that scene, before he leaves, he hugs his mother goodbye and says, good luck with your puzzle. And that was very metaphoric about, you know, good luck with figuring out what we were all doing here in the first place. Yeah.
Good luck figuring out the meaning of life in the next 5 hours.
Yes, exactly. And I thought that was so powerful, but it was so subtly done. But the fact that it was so noticed, because the cinematographer lingered on that, so you were supposed to notice. That's kind of what I got out of that. I don't know if that's true. I tried looking that up. No reviews mentioned it, but I picked it up. So,
and you know what? This is the fourth time. Well, there's four times in this film that our lead character becomes basically forgiven as the prodigal son. And the first is with the little girl when he saves her. The second is with Vicky when she lets him go. The third is this scene when the mother accepts him back after their, distance that they've had, you know, for whatever reasons, whether it's fights, whether it's, you know, something he did, whether it's something she did, doesn't matter, but she accepts him back. And then the fourth is when Zoe eventually takes him back at the end of the film as well. And so I think that whole scene, you know, never mind, you know, what's the meaning of life. It's also the third time in the film that he, as the prodigal son, is welcomed back by the quote unquote father, or, you know, that's what the story is. It's a father, not a mother. But you know what I'm saying. And I think that was pretty powerful as well about this whole scene. Eric, now you brought up the bunker scene, and this scene was probably as important, even if it was a more quiet scene. Details, your opinion. What happened? What's going on here?
I thought it was mostly about the two of them making peace with each other before the end.
Indeed. And Mike, what was your opinion of this scene? Because obviously the mother has some importance to the film, yet she was only in the film for 10 minutes, you could argue. I mean, she's the one that lets him go on his journey, right? She says, "You take that little girl to her father," because at first she was like, "Why are you bringing this little girl here?" And then at the end, she says, "This is your mission. This is who you are. You take her to her father."
Well, I mean, he's at the end of his life. They all are, but he's, by going back to his mom, he's kind of going back to the beginning, right?
Oh, that's a good point. Excellent analogy.
And so it's sort of, it's a full circle, is that he's coming around and he's going to end up going back from there. He's going to drop the little girl off. But he's going to end up back with his not wife, with the mother of his child.
Yeah, so
whatever. The bimbo number two, whatever she was, girlfriend number two. So, yeah, I mean, this is a sign of him, you know, kind of growing up. You know, that he's being aware that she's, look, you know, we have this notion, which is not always as true as we'd like it to be, but, you know, that the one person who's always going to love you is your mom. And, yep. You know, and there, and here's a mom who's written her child off. So that says a lot about who he was, or who he was at the beginning of the film. And, you know, that he can reconcile that. You know, he's gone back to his mom and it's almost made peace with that, can move on with that. It is, you could argue, if you want to get pretentious about it, sort of a rebirth. You know, it's allowing him to move forward and sort of begin anew, if I'm being pretentious and horseshitty about it.
No, that's a good point. That's fair, and you could get that if you want to go quote real art house avant garde or esoteric.
Or maybe they needed an extra 10 minutes to make sure the movie could get into theaters. That's another possibility.
But the other interesting thing that happens at that scene is that she tells that whole story about how she drove to the house. And she saw, you know, you get the sense that she had written him off, that she has seen her grandchildren and her daughter, presumably James's sister.
Well she went to the house, right? Her sister,
yeah.
The sister's house.
And they didn't answer the
home.
Door.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
She's like, they weren't home. They didn't answer the door. And there was a sublime patheticness in that.
Chrissy, if I could interject, the best line was when he goes, didn't you go inside? She goes, how could I go inside? They weren't home.
Yeah.
And you know, and in other words, she was too clueless to go and check on them, like unlike him, who actually went inside and found them all dead, basically.
Well, and that moment to me kind of said on a very core level, to go a little deeper, is that, again, it gets back to who we really are as people. Was the daughter and the grandkids and the daughter's husband putting on a show all these years for the grandmother, you know, for her mom? We're the perfect family. We live in this great house. We have a pool. One particularly creepy scene was where he enters the house. We see the Christmas tree.
Yeah,
the album full of pictures, and Rose is like, it's not Christmas.
Yeah, the little girl, Rose, she goes, why is there Christmas things? There's not Christmas. And even though he understands it, it's like the end of the world and quote-unquote Christmas must make her sister happy.
Yeah, and then there's like a million empty booze bottles right next to the photo album.
Yeah.
So they were clearly not the people that James's mother thought they were.
Right,
and James's mother kind of allowed herself to think that. And then when James came home, the mother was like, I had written you off years ago, which was so painful. And yet in the end, who came back? James. So that goes back to that whole prodigal son thing you were talking about, was that James is really the person who truly loved his mom, whereas I kind of got the sense from all that the sister was kind of like putting on a show. But that was just my own opinion. So,
and I think you could also say that her not going in, well, they weren't home, that can go back to the buddy with the bomb shelter, right? He wants to believe the bomb shelter will do it. Mom may be clueless.
They're not home.
But yeah, the alternative is something she would rather not believe. So she can't change it. If she wants to believe they made a last minute trip to Disney World, she can believe that. Or she can believe as she dies that her child committed suicide and murdered the grandchildren and maybe even their little dog Toto too.
Well, in our lead character, you got to like him because he comes out and he says, I guess they weren't home. In other words, he didn't want, he wasn't, if he was a real jerk or if he was, you know, more shallow, he would have go, see, their whole life was crap. You always picked on me and said I was a loser, but they were losers too. Look what she did. But instead of doing all that, he just,
he lies. He says he found a note. He says he, right? Doesn't he say, oh, I found a note. Right. They said they left.
Yeah.
So, exactly. Which also, by the way, shows growth from where he was at the party, where he's screaming reality in their face rather than living with their comfortable lie.
Right. Right.
Because it would only hurt her more if he told her the truth.
Exactly. And it's not worth it. It's not right. And he still loves his mother no matter what differences they've had. And so why be a fucking dink and instead be the person that
the
he
party
should
pooper.
Be. Yeah. Well, not even a party pooper, but the person.
I've been throwing that term.
Yeah, I know. No, I know what you mean. But so it was kind of cool that he was that way and he did that for his mother in a sense because that honestly that's what he did. He did a favor for his mother that. Which is that.
And Phil, I appreciate your selectively conservative language. You just called that guy a fucking dink. So it's okay to say fucking, but call him a fucking dick is too far. You gotta scale it back and say dink.
Fair enough.
I think he was deliberately choosing to express a colorful metaphor.
That's right.
You know, that for variety rather than
there you go, variety. Spice of life.
Exactly.
Rather than just rephrasing from saying dick in front of a lady.
Let's see. I guess we should talk about the last two scenes, which is basically the scene when he brings her back to her father, the little girl to his father, and then the scene where he gets back with Zoe. So let's discuss the scene where he brings the little girl back to her father. Basically, her father said, if we ever get split up, go to your aunt's house, basically his sister's house, and I'll be there. And
Auntie Janet says, and can I just make one reference here that I thought was hysterical?
Please.
They get to the party. Only one. They get to the party, and there's this orgy going on. He walks the little girl through the party, and she looks at him and says, I don't think any of these people are going to take me to Auntie Janice's house.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
It was just funny. It was one moment in this film of comedic breakup.
Actually, to be honest, there's a few of them. And let me give a couple examples because they're important to the character of the little girl, how she is as a little girl, and yet she's so wise by the end of the film. He goes, go swimming. Well, you know, basically he knows his sister basically suicided based off of how the house is. And he goes, go outside and go in the backyard and go swimming. She goes, but I don't have my swimsuit. He goes, swim in your dress. Who cares? And she goes, oh, okay. That's cool. And that's what a little girl would do. And then the scene where he says, you're a strong chick. And she goes, yeah, I'm a strong chick. Say it louder. You're a strong kid. And she, you know, she does it. And you know, this funny thing. So she's a little girl there too. And then there's the scene, as you just mentioned, where she's still a little girl, at the party. And then yet at the end, in the scene we're about to discuss, she shows that she's also a little wiser by the end of the film than her years show based off of her experience with him and then her understanding of him and his situation, which is kind of interesting. So let's get into this scene. Let's get into the scene where they go to Aunt Jenny's house.
Well, basically they get there and nobody's immediately apparent. So they're wandering around looking to see where everybody is. And they find that, everybody did go there. But I guess they decided they weren't going to wait around for the end. And it appears that they all shot each other and then some of them shot themselves or whatnot. So basically everybody's dead. So, he finds the father's dead body, and then he split up with Rose. So Rose had been somewhere else. He finds the father's dead body. He hears Rose coming and then runs towards her and prevents her from finding her family dead. And she's screaming at her to put her down. and he doesn't want to let her go because he doesn't want her to see the dead bodies because he's afraid it'll upset her. But eventually he puts her down and she stops yelling at him and she just says to him, "I need to see him. I need to see my dad." And he's like, "Well, okay, that's perfectly reasonable, yeah, actually." So he lets her go, say goodbye to her father.
And then actually what happens is he wants to take her with him.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. she says no. He wraps the dad up in a sheet and carries him into this glen on the Anti-Genesis property, which is very beautiful. And it was kind of interesting there because it almost looked very Cretaceous period to me. I know Mike will know what I'm talking about.
Here we go again.
Some weird crap. No, I'll keep it short. But it looked very Cretaceous period.
Say something nice about apples just to satisfy him.
Yeah, yeah. And he wraps him in a sheet and he's like, "Come with me." And she says, "No, this is where I belong.
Exactly. I belong.
You need to go where you belong." And she, it was interesting because a couple of the reviews that I read after I had watched the film, it was interesting because the reviews out of the UK were saying that this film was too heavy-handed.
Yeah, I saw those too. Yeah.
Right. But the American reviews were saying, "This is great. It's so subtle."
Yeah.
So that was kind of a real eye opener for me and how much we in the Americas beat each other over the head with our symbolism. Whereas in the UK, they were like, "This is kind of like dumbed down for everybody to get." But she says, "This is where you belong." And that goes back to the conversation with Vicky, where Vicky was like, "This is where you belong. You need to go where you belong. Where do you belong, James?" Which he clearly doesn't belong at the party. So he leaves her. And then finally, as he's trying to – go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to interject. She says to him, however, basically meaning you are not leaving me. You're still in my heart because she says, "I'm going to follow you until I can't see you anymore while you drive away." And she runs after the car.
That scene broke my heart.
Yeah. And
that
even though
so sad.
And then she hugs him and he's like, "Do I supposed to hug you back?" And that was interesting too. And then also, in other words, he didn't know how important he was to her until the fact he was driving away. And then he said, "Oh my God." So she hugged me because I was that important to her. She's chasing after my car, waving to me because I'm that important to her. Her father and her aunt and everybody in her family suicided. And yet she's not depressed because she knows she's going to die anyway, but she's actually happy because she found someone in the world that actually cares about life and her and all these other things along with her family who are all dead, unfortunately. But I am actually loved and I'm important and all these other things. And it's like, wow. And it's just amazing because here's this little girl who should be like in, you would think if the world wasn't end, she would be devastated. Her whole family's dead. And yet she's understanding the whole thing. And she's saying to James, "You are important to me, what you did for me. Now go where you have to go. And I love you as a human being," and on and on and on. And it was just a great scene. I understand why you felt that way, Chrissy.
Well, I did. And also, I have actually done that where I've driven away from somewhere where I know there's a friend I'm not going to see again for a long time. And I've done that whole watching them wave until they're gone from my rearview mirror. And I realize not many people do that, but I have done it. And even though the person isn't dying or the person isn't leaving me forever, or, you know, it's maybe like my friend in Utah or whatever, and I'm not going to see them again for many, many years. That scene really struck me. I mean, I started crying because I've done that. And I know how sad it was. And then he starts crying when he's leaving. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm a mess now.
Yeah, because he's crying.
Where's the Anisette? I'm done. Yeah.
And especially the martinis. Because you expect something like from a an American version for the film to have him bring her along or something like that.
Yes, so I thought exactly.
It was very. it was very gutsy that the she actually stayed behind to be with her father for her even though he's already gone. And that was very powerful. And it was both heartwarming but absolutely absolute tearjerker. But as I said, it was because compared to some of what we do in the States, you know, to have James bring her along, I expect him to go along with letting her just stay there. I really didn't expect that to happen. So I thought that was a great move on the director's part.
I didn't either.
I think it showed a lot of great writing strength from Hilditch.
Well, I'll say one thing, too. It reminded me of, oddly, and it's a completely different genre and everything, this film called About Schmidt, starring Jack Nicholson, where at the end of the film, he gets a letter from his pen pal that he donates, you know, $20 a month to some poor kid in Africa and whatever. And you know, you never, you know, it's just this anonymous kid in Africa that you're sending $20 to the nuns to give out for food and medicine and whatnot. But the organization still says, send letters. The child will want to hear from you. And, you know, you never think the letters are actually going to get to the kid. And yet Jack Nicholson, as part of the exposition of this film about Schmidt, he writes these letters to the kid, and they're always negative, like, my daughter hates me and blah, 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 and all this other crap. And at the very end of the film, spoiler alert, he gets a letter
back. It turns out to be Idi Amin.
He gets a letter back from a nun that's taking care of this little boy in Africa that is getting the money that he sends. And it says, the nun says, I read the letters to him because he can't read and whatnot. And he loves when he gets these letters from you, you know, even if the letters say my daughter's a jerk and whatever. You've meant so much to him, and what you've done for him is wonderful. And he's decided to draw this picture, and I've mailed it to you. And it's a picture of a son with the little boy holding the hand of the nun or something like that. And Jack Nicholson just begins to cry because he has this old man that his wife's dead, who never loved him, and his child doesn't care for him, and on and on and on. And suddenly this little boy he's never met that he made a difference to and loves him from on the other side of the world that he's never met, and he starts bawling his eyes out. And this kind of reminded me of that scene, because here is James just made a difference to somebody that he didn't even know 12 hours earlier. And at the last moment of his life, someone considers him more important than anybody else. And he starts bawling his eyes out, similar to Jack Nicholson's character in About Schmidt. And it was very effective. Excellent screenwriting by the director in this case, as you mentioned, Chrissy and Abe.
Well, and I think, too, it also speaks to that human element in all of us that Mike was talking about earlier, when, like, you never know when the last time is you're going to talk to somebody.
You never know. Right.
It could be your coworker. It could be somebody you don't really know. It could be somebody from high school. I mean, Mike went into this earlier, but, you know, it speaks to that in all of us, that this is the last time. There's a finality to it. And inevitably, when we part as people, we could all say, okay, like, I'm all on this podcast with you guys right now. Let's be realistic. Nobody knows whether this is the last time I'm going to talk to you guys. Nobody knows. I mean, let's go dark here. That's what this movie's about.
Did somebody tip you off?
No. But my point is, you never know when the last time is. And that's why I think that scene in particular was so effective. Because we actually knew. As an audience, we knew. The characters knew. That was the last time. It wasn't like, oh, Rose, I'm so sad. I'm going to miss you. I'm seeing you waving goodbye in my rearview mirror. Maybe I'll see you in a couple of years. Maybe we'll reconnect in 20 years. You know? That's it. Right. When you're gone from my rearview mirror, you are gone.
Yep.
We're all gone. And that is, I think, the true power of this film, is that it speaks to the language of grief, and it speaks to the language of who are we really, and whatever.
So. Well, and it's also the overpowering of the human spirit and people, and and at least the main characters in the film, how they surpass grief. They break through the wall of grief. What we get is basically the point that you made, Mike, earlier, which is an apocalyptic film that's, no matter how depressing, has a happiness to it, because the people are breaking through the grief, even if they are doomed.
Right, because, in the end, they're fictional characters, so that helps.
First of all, it's not my dog, it's Abe's dog, not mine.
What is Abe's dog doing in your house?
No, that's the only other person that has a dog out of everybody here is Abe, and it ain't my dog that's making all that noise.
But anyway, so fictional characters, and it's a fictional, although frighteningly plausible scenario. It's the truth is, in the end, we were all again going to end up there. We're just not all likely to end up going there at exactly the same time. So we all will end up dead. And it's
for
how
ruining
you go
the
out.
Night, Mike. You fucking
oh yeah, like the whole evening hasn't been freaking depressing, right? But
you just made it real. I'm Vicky now, and I'm pissed. But now I'm Freddy, and I'm pissed.
But this brings us is that you can go out on a high note. You can go out, having grown up, repaired your relationships, fixed your mistakes, and go out with someone you love. That's not a bad way to go if you got to go.
And you know what? It doesn't even matter because we're all dead anyway. But if we really want to look existentially, it really means it's a stupid thing when you think about it. But honestly, that's not the point. So yeah, but you're absolutely right, Mike.
And Abe earlier was saying how powerful that scene was when he said goodbye to the little girl. But talk about powerful, man! The ending of this movie, holy shit!
That
last shot was something else.
Oh, it really.
It had stuff on my shelves rattling from the bass.
Oh, no kidding. My wife actually called me on my cell phone because she, I'm downstairs in the basement with my cell phone, and she goes, I can hear it two floors up in the bedroom at the bass. Shut it off. I say, oh, sorry.
But that shot of the firestorm approaching was absolutely just haunting. It was absolutely,
and then Zoe, what she said, she goes, it looks so beautiful. And yet James is still, his face is like in horror, and yet she's already accepted it as like, this is nature, this is life. We're with nature.
In the first scene of the film, she does say to him, "You're going to get a great view of it from here."
Uh-huh.
She does say that. Yeah, it's going to be so say, great yeah. to watch from here.
Yeah, so, because they're like it's like almost like a beach house right on the water, right?
Right.
Yeah, right on the shore.
Yeah.
Well, and then at the very end, like after she says it's so beautiful, it goes white, and they held on a white screen for like,
yes, that was awesome,
10, 20 mm-hmm. seconds.
They did the same thing at Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, though.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which I don't know if was earlier or after this movie was made.
I don't know either, because this was apparently on the shelf for a while.
It was the right. It was the right thing to do, though. It was the right choice. They could have shown some stupid shit, and they didn't.
It was especially effective because once it goes to black to the credits, you don't hear any music. You just hear this kind of almost static rumbling sound throughout. There's no soundtrack or nothing. There's just this weird background noise.
Yeah, that's true.
Right, and when he was at the house with, when he was at Auntie Janice's house, which was like maybe an hour and a half before it hit, you started to hear the rumbling. His last moments with Rose, you were hearing the rumbling of it coming,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was very effective too. It was that impending sense of doom. But to lighten it up a little bit, there is an asteroid that scientists estimate may hit us in 2032.
Okay, how are we lightening this up?
Well, but here's
really
here's the good news.
Really?
Yeah. The good news is the chances of it hitting us are actually 1 in 63,000.
Okay.
NASA says there is a 99.998% of it missing us. But if you want to have some fun, you can go to killerasteroids.org, where you can play a game and center on a town that you hate. And if an asteroid hits it, you can see what kind of devastation it will do. So, just for a good time.
Like Mike said, it doesn't matter because we're all dead anyway. So.
Yeah, I know, but I've done it a few times. I'm so guilty, but yeah, it's fun.
to lighten it up a little bit, you mentioned the film, Chrissy, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
I think every
man would like to find Keira Knightley as their best friend at the end of the world.
Yeah.
But that's besides
I'll take her as a casual acquaintance.
Well, no, I think the best evening would be to watch this film first and then watch Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, because it's the same premise, but Seeking a Friend for the End of the World is a lot more fun, a lot more lighthearted. So it makes fun of a lot of stuff. So at least you feel better about the fact that you're going to die in 12 hours.
Right. So, yeah, I mean the film is obviously depressing, and it ends, I mean, Abe, you mentioned it perfectly, which is, you know, the credits basically go to black and quiet, meaning, you know, there's nothing more and whatever. But Mike did make a good point, which is also it's quote-unquote happiness, or at least a brighter side to the most depressing film ever, because it's the value of relationships, human life, who we are as people, self-dignity, as well as love for others, and how our characters, main characters, as well as some of the peripherals, including Vicky and Zoe, break through the wall of gloom and see at least a meaning to life. When, in fact, you could argue existentially there is no meaning, because the end of the world is there and that's it. So it is interesting concept, the whole thing. And to use a meteor for modern day in humans versus what happened probably with the dinosaurs was a brilliant concept to bring to light, since I don't think it really has happened in any notable apocalyptic films until this one, at least to my knowledge. Any further scenes that anybody wanted to bring up that we missed, or points they wanted to bring up? Anyone?
Well, I did want to point out, Phil, that I am a little surprised you like this movie.
Oh, why is that?
Well, because it literally kills all the dogs.
Indeed.
Every dog.
Yeah.
Unless there's a dog and it fell down a 2 mile deep well. They're all dead.
Yeah, there.
Yeah.
That actually is something I weirdly thought of, is when he finds the body of the girl's father.
Yes, yes.
And there's the fly buzzing around.
Oh, yeah. Another fly.
Yeah.
Like the one with the puppy.
And I just find myself, when I found myself, I was thinking, you know, that fly doesn't know he's fucked.
And that
expanded because, you know, it's Australia and there's everything. And we all know that hiding behind every tree, there was something waiting to kill the character.
Never mind the person behind the tree.
Right, because it's Australia.
Jesus, Mike.
Humans, the people, like this meteor or asteroid or whatever hits Western Europe, all the animals living everywhere else in the world don't know they're screwed.
Right.
We, thanks to mass communication, are well aware of our doom. If this had happened, you know...
Mike, if I could interject for a second.
Yeah.
That's the thing that's always been an interesting concept through literary fiction, never mind a film like this, is the fact that humans, unlike any other animal, are the only animal in the world that know of their mortality. And this just brings it a little, well, that's true, but this just brings it more into perspective because it's only 12 hours. But, you know, like you're right, you know, the fly or the bug or the dog or whatever doesn't know because, you know, they don't know about death in a sense. And yet humans know that we're dead in whatever amount of years and whatnot. And in this case, in 12 hours.
Right. And literally 100 years ago, the people in Australia, or well, maybe 150 years ago, the people in Australia would have been just as clueless about the fact that they were about to die as that fly is. Right? I mean, they wouldn't have discovered the meteor. There wouldn't have been a way
they would have
to get a message through.
They know that they were going to die in the sense that they're going to die at, you know, of old age, if anything.
No, I mean, right now. Like, yeah, that, okay. And that they were dead, but they didn't know it yet.
Yeah, all right, that's fair. Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, it's just again, it's an interesting idea that that's something that, you know, if you had a dog, you couldn't explain to the dog, we're all going to die soon, Fluffy. There's no point in feeding you right now.
Yes, but then, how do you explain that before something like a massive volcanic eruption, the birds and the bees and the bugs are gone? They're devoid of the area. So they may not have a conscious awareness like we do, thinking, but there's something that tells them to leave.
But those are things that's tied to a very, very terrestrial event and maybe picking up on things instinctively that we're not picking up on because that's very different than rock dropping out of the sky.
Okay, that's
which happens so rarely there won't be any selective pressure in favor of that.
Right, and I think the fly, too, like you mentioned the fly a second time, the fly in this movie is a symbol of humanity, that we are but a speck in the eye. Whether or not you believe in God or the fates or whatever you believe in, the higher power, even if you don't believe in a higher power, even if you're an atheist, the symbol of the fly in this film is a symbol of how we buzz and buzz and buzz, and yet we're not really heard. We really don't have control over our fate or what's going to happen. So,
well, we don't know
my deep thought for the night.
Or not, but yeah. It's, well, again, I'll go back to that. I don't remember who said it, but it was that, you know, that either we are the only intelligent life for the universe or we're not. And either thought is rather profound and disturbing. So,
but there's water on Mars now, so who knows?
But intelligent life, we're not talking about pond scum.
Well, I disagree. I don't know. There could be intelligent bacterium or single-celled animals. Maybe not.
Off rails.
All I know is Matt Damon's on Mars, and we've got to get him back, damn it.
So yeah, I think we'll probably wrap it up. If there's any further things you guys want to mention about specific scenes, or whatever, we'll do it in our final thoughts. So I guess we'll go around the round table. Hey, why don't you start?
I recommend this film. It's a slow burn kind of film. There's no action scenes. If you're looking for something that's exciting or something like that, like some in the world or post or, you know, disaster films are these most of the these days, you're not going to find it with these final hours. It's a human drama focuses on the human characters. It's got great atmosphere, fantastic acting. It's very haunting, but as some of us have noted, it's, despite how bleak it is, it's got a very positive message, and it's got some very memorable scenes, and I suggest you go check it out. I mean, I would even suggest that it's a film you should possibly own. And for me, at least, it's a standout in the genre, alongside with one of my favorite books, The Road, which I really enjoyed when I read a while back.
It's a great movie too. Great movie.
Yeah, I got to see the movie. I remember really liking the book. But I should definitely check that out too.
Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, The Road. This, I mean, I think these those kind of films separate themselves because of, instead of focusing on big visual effects of buildings falling down or all explosions and stuff, they focus on the dilemmas of the people caught in it. And I suggest, so check it out.
Excellent. Very good. All right, Christy, what about yourself?
I'm going to go ahead and say I loved this film. I think that everyone should see it. I'm also going to highly recommend The Wave by Peter Weir, which I believe was 1976. He's the same guy who did Picnic at Hanging Rock, which is a completely different type of film. But this film is very sad, and it's very depressing. And if you don't like that sort of hopelessness and desperation, which is expertly done, then stay away from it. And if you don't like to think, stay away from it. Other than that, embrace it. It's a wonderful film, and it's definitely, I'm so glad, Eric, that you mentioned it, because, wow, this movie changed my life. It's really made me think. So, high recommend for me. Go see it.
All right. Yep, for me, just as a film, genre films for 2015, I'd say it's the second best genre film of 2015 after It Follows. I would say so. It would definitely be one of the best films of speculative fiction, in my opinion. I absolutely adored this film. I thought it was fantastic. The acting was awesome all around, from our lead actor to the little girl to our peripheral characters. And yet, a lot of the things we've been talking about is more directly related to the writing itself. So the screenwriting itself is unbelievable, never mind the directing. Everything about the film is fantastic, the cinematography. The only thing that I'm disappointed in is that when I looked up about the Blu-ray, I found out that it doesn't really have any extras. So I was hoping to purchase the Blu-ray because I wanted to hear like commentary and
right.
behind the scenes and all this other great stuff.
Yeah,
and
that pissed me off, just for the record.
There should be a lot of Blu-rays have to have a commentary.
Yeah, it should be a lot. Yeah. Absolutely. Because it's bullshit. I just don't want to watch the movie over and over. I want to hear more. I want to learn more. So
Oh, yeah. And absolutely. From all the actors to the director himself, it would have been fantastic to get something like that. And unfortunately, we don't have that, at least with this latest edition of the Blu-ray. Fortunately, everybody can at least watch it on Netflix. I did read, however, that the Blu-ray transfer is one of the best, especially for a film like this with all the long shots and the background and Perth in the distance and whatnot. But again, high recommend by me. Everything that Christy and Abe said, I'm right there with them. What about you, Mike?
I look forward to rewatching this movie from the beginning, so I can be fully awake and alert through the whole thing, and pick up on a lot of stuff that we missed. And there's certainly things I'll be looking for, like every power phone line and cable. It was a
also look at barriers too. There was a lot of barrier imagery,
right?
Which feeds into that same motif, but anyway.
Yeah, I don't want to. I want to say this is an enjoyable movie, because it's not, but it is an interesting watch. And if you're interested in something serious and depressing, but uplifting, where they kill all the dogs, this isn't a bad one to do. And I would also recommend that if you are a Hulu subscriber, that they have all the Criterion films available for streaming.
Oh, nice.
Which includes The Last Wave.
Oh, nice.
So if you're interested in watching,
that's cool.
Miss Schoonover's recommendation, you could watch it there.
Right. So free on Hulu, as long as you're a subscriber to Hulu, you get to see that free. That's cool.
Free on Hulu if you pay for Hulu.
If you pay for Hulu. And it's also therefore logical deduction, also available to purchase as a Criterion disc. So if you really like the movie, you could probably overpay for a Criterion disc that'll have commentaries and
so forth
and stuff.
Nice.
For free, as long as you pay for it.
Very good. All right. And Eric, your final thoughts.
Well, I can't disagree with anybody that has gone before me. I think it's an excellent film. I would recommend this to listeners of this podcast, but I wouldn't recommend it for everybody because, like Christy was saying, it goes dark, and not everybody has the fortitude to go that dark. We're probably a little desensitized at this point. And I know some people have trouble with that. So if you are sensitive to really dark movies, you might want to skip this one. But if you enjoy that kind of thing, like the majority of our listeners do, then go right ahead and check it out. It's an excellent movie with great acting. And I'm glad we got to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Just one of those hidden gems that just pop up on Netflix like Come Back to Me did last year. Definitely want to see more of the writer-director Zach Hilditch. And I would love to see more of Nathan Phillips because he's this is actually probably the first film I've seen that he's actually the 100% lead of a film. And he's an absolutely fantastic actor. And hope to see him get more leading roles rather than supporting roles as he had in Wolf Creek and other films like that.
I'd also like to see more of Sarah Snook because she only had a small part in this movie, but she did a good job again. She's done a good job anytime I've seen her in anything, so I want to see more.
Yeah, I liked her Jaws impersonation in this film. Right.
Yep, absolutely. She just
cut into the water. I don't know if somebody mentioned it, but the movie is less than 90 minutes, right?
86.
Yeah,
yep.
86, yeah.
86 minutes. So this is a film where they make their point, and as has been said, they don't necessarily always do it with the most subtle touch. But I think another like 30 minutes or even 20 minutes would have really started to turn.
No, because, absolutely.
You know, it's sort of like Forrest Gump for me. It's like by the time we get to the running scene, I'm done with the movie. I got the point.
I think it would have dragged. I don't need
too much longer anymore. Yeah. So I think it's an appropriate running time because I didn't sit here going, boy, I wish that movie kept going. I didn't feel like I missed anything. I think it's a nice, about as bite-sized of film as you can get.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, it's one of those films that there's not one part of the film that would have me take a second to say, well, actually, you know what, I'm not going to put the disc back into the DVD player because I don't know, that one scene is going to, I don't feel like watching right now. This whole film from the beginning to the end doesn't have any of those type of scenes. So you're absolutely right. The 86 minute running time, every scene of the film doesn't drag or cause any like issues where I'm like, oh, so, good point there, Mike. All right. So, that's These Final Hours, Australian film by Zach Hilditch. Produced by Liz Kearney, starring Nathan Phillips and Angourie Rice, along with Jessica DeGaulle and Catherine Beck. And Daniel Herschel plays Freddy. So with that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in to listen to us talk about These Final Hours. Come back next week. We'll have a different topic. We'll be right back.